where I live.
RoboZone coming up. He's got a long way to go.
Retro Gaming Radio 2012. Keep it retro. Hello, folks. Welcome to the January 2012 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. I'm Shane R. Monroe, your host. Welcome to the program. Well, it's finally 2012, the year of the end, right? 2012, the Mayan calendar ends, Planet X circles back, and we're going to be invaded. Whatever mythos you believe in for the 2012 prophecies, it's not going to matter at all here at Retro Gaming Radio, because we have a full year of incredible shows planned out for you, some of them already in production as we speak. I like to start off the new year, especially 2012 new year, with some of my own predictions for the future of gaming. I've done this a few times before, and a lot of people seem to like it. So I compiled a list of a few things that I would like to offer up as predictions for the coming new year. First, there's another intellectual property crackdown coming. Not in the form of SOPA or any of this other stuff. But there's another IP crackdown coming, and it all revolves around the mobile market. The Ataris, the Activisions, the Electronic Arts have a huge backlog of intellectual property that was designed for an older age. Commodore 64, Amiga, NES, right? So we have all of this old software with old IPs that they just couldn't really get to fly. You know, they try to make the Spy Hunters and the Galaga Destination Earth and all this other stuff, but they have these very valuable IPs that could be useful in a brand new marketplace. And that's really what the mobile market, the tablets, the personal, I'll call them personal electronic devices, cell phones, tablets, even dedicated, shall we say, grayware type handheld systems, of one of which we're going to talk about this month. These sort of things are all up and coming, and they all offer up a ripe opportunity for these older established companies like Atari, like Activision, like Electronic Arts. These guys are all primed and set and ready to start bringing this stuff out. You're not going to get Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3 playing on the tablet very well, no matter how Tegra 3 it is or whatever, because it's simply not the right control scheme for it. You know, we all know that controls are king. We've talked about this in past episodes. There are certain things that work very well on tablets or personal electronic devices, and there are some things that just don't. In reality, it tends to be the more simple items that work, right? Maybe a single four-direction joystick, you can get away with putting a touchpad on the screen, and people deal with it. But let's take a look at something slightly more complicated. How about Robotron? Robotron would be horrible using virtual controls. But there's a huge arsenal of four-way, eight-way, single-button games and IPs out there that I have a feeling the hammer's going to fall this year. And it's all around, and it's all due to mobile market, personal electronic devices. Speaking of which, there will be no real gaming solutions for these personal electronic devices, but there will be tons of options. And we've already seen some of the Consumer Electronics Show this for 2012. We've seen devices that let you stick your iPhone into like an Atari Lynx looking case, turning it sideways and have actual controls being played. We have things like the iCade, which give you the ability to use a Bluetooth connection to your tablet or to your cell phone and use actual arcade controls on it. Of course, the problem is getting that sort of market acceptance of that product, and to get that sort of penetration where developers actually start wanting to use it. As always, anytime you produce a electronic gaming device that does not have an innate control system that is what you want to use, then you're going to have developers not using it. You can't add something on later and expect that every third-party developer will utilize the product. We saw that with the Nintendo Wii. The balance board actually got remarkable third-party support. The UDraw tablet that got added on. And there are tons of examples of other things like that in the classic gaming world as well. Anyway, so there'll be tons of third-party devices and options for controllers and pseudo-solutions. They're very desperate. There's a desperation that people are finally starting to realize that mobile devices, personal electronic devices, are not great game machines unless they are actually designed to be a game machine. So you're seeing a little desperate grasp of the market, and you'll see that throughout 2012, but there will be no good solution up until maybe next year we'll see something. I predict almost a video game crash again. Now, we've talked about this before. I predicted a video game crash was going to happen. And as it turned out, I also said that it was averted the last time. We got lucky. However, we are seeing a different type of video game issue at this point in time. And the problem that we're having isn't that there's too much product for the shelves anymore, right? Because that was the big deal. The market got flooded with cheap, uncontrolled software. Now, this emerging market, this very, very young mobile gaming market, portable electronic device market, they are very young, and they are already being flooded in ways that you know, the 2600 never saw. You know, 500,000 apps up on an app store. 300,000, 500,000, 700,000. Let's even say 50% of them are games. I mean, what platform in the past has had 250,000 games available? And as such, we're having the same sort of problem with quality control. You know, even the beloved Apple isn't controlling the quality of what gets put up there. And of course, Android is the last bastion of open season. Amazon is running their own app store under the Kindle Fire, but again, the problem is that there is no certification program. There is nothing. Some people are trying it. Sony's trying it with their Xperia program, but none of these things are really doing the job. They're not solving the issue, and we've already got so much to wade through that the average user, unless they're willing to go out and research and go to gaming sites, go to websites, and have a vetting process, they have trouble actually finding quality titles. That's a problem, and there's going to be more of that problem in the coming year. The PSP Vita, next in the PSP line from Sony, I predict that it will be cracked in 2012. It's already been unlocked, but it hasn't really become useful yet. And it will do what PSPs do the best, which will become a great portable emulation device. I predict this time around, with the PSP Vita, you're going to be able to play PS2 and GameCube games, Dreamcast games, all at full speed on the PSP Vita. So that is my prediction for that platform. You can forget about it. It's going to be forget about it as a commercial gaming endeavor. It's going to become a great emulation device. So that's when everyone will start picking it up. Also in 2012, I do predict that the PC will return to a proper pillar of gaming. Let's be honest. The PC's had a lot of competition in the last 10 years. We've had console gaming. We've had portable gaming, dedicated gaming devices. And now we have these personal entertainment devices, sometimes doubling as cell phones or tablets. And that's taking up a chunk of the pie. However, I do believe that the PC is going to see a resurgence. And the reason for that is very, very simple. Part of it's going to have to do with the sneaking in of HTML5. Now, I've said it up before on one of my other shows that Chrome, the Google browser, and Google themselves, I personally believe they are secretly working at turning the PC into a gaming device again. And not using any digital locker crap or any sort of proprietary Steam, download the client, do all this crap. They're sneaking in under the radar. They're using their Chrome store and HTML5 and all of their geniuses over there, and they're creating they're secretly creating a game machine out of the Chrome browser. You'll be able to use the Chrome browser as a window into emulation, all the stuff that's being played on mobile devices, the Angry Birds, the Cut the Rope, all of those things are played great in a browser, right? So this is what I think Google's secretly doing. That's going to be the frontier. They're going to take a big chunk out of the entertainment, and they're going to use the PC to do it. Along with the fact that you're starting to see, you're continuing, I should say, to see top-notch AAA titles such as Call of Duty Modern Warfare 3 and Skyrim and all of these other huge titles doing very, very well on the PC platform, where before they had a modest following. I predict, too, that in the next generation of console gaming and PC gaming will start to merge. We're going to start seeing cross-platform playability, cross-platform leaderboards, that sort of thing. I think that will be Microsoft's next step because they need the Windows market to continue to thrive, and they're going to be taking their Xbox and merging it in with Windows. So much, in fact, that if you're willing to buy into the Microsoft platform, their phone, their tablet, their operating system, and their console, it's almost going to be a ubiquitous gaming scenario across the board. It'll be interesting to see if they can pull it off, because that's a stunt that I don't even think Microsoft can do. I think the approach that Google is secretly taking, and I have no proof of this, I think that's the approach that's going to win inevitably in the end. So those are my predictions for 2012. I thought it'd be nice to open up the show with that. I do want to mention that Retro Gaming Radio has primarily been a Shane Armanrow production, right? I've had various assistants. I've had co-hosts. And I do believe that the show could use at least another voice. I know that in the past I have brought in several guest speakers on a per-show basis, and a lot of people didn't really care for that approach. They didn't like other people other than me, versus, except for like in interviews, right? Everyone loves the interviews. But they wanted me to keep the show more pure. So my goal is going to be to bring a guest speaker in every few months to document something that I don't have a rich history in, like MS-DOS gaming. I don't have a huge history in that. Spectrum. I don't have a lot of specy information or knowledge. Early gaming consoles, NES, Super NES. I was still a PC or a computer guy back then, so I wasn't really playing things on that platform. But they deserve to have representation here. So our first one should be up next month. Alex J. Lopez is going to come in with DOS-based gaming. He's going to do a segment for us. We'll see how it goes. We'll get your reactions. And if you like it, maybe we'll do more. If you don't like it, maybe we'll do less. And we'll see what sort of demands you guys have and what you guys would like to hear here on the show. So what do we have up for the show? A little quick summary for you, for those of you wondering what's going on this month. We're going to announce a brand new contest, our first contest since returning back to Retro Gaming Radio. It's the iHeart Commodore 64, the 30 years later promotion. We're going to have a contest, brand new contest, win prizes. We're going to go. We're going to read some reader mail. I have got a 30-year anniversary of the greatest era of gaming. 1982, of course, is probably the banner year for gaming. And I've got a nice little editorial commentary to explain to you why. We are also, of course, having our rich bits and bytes. We have tons of stuff. And, of course, you've been waiting patiently, I might add, for David Thiel's part two of his interview, our interactive sound engineer guy. And a lot of you are dying for the pinball piece of the segment, and that's going to be coming up this month. And we, of course, have a couple of small reviews for you. We're going to take a look at Dragon's Lair on the Android platform. And we've got a couple updates on the Mighty Zen pinball, because a lot of people have written in and said that they really enjoyed getting some pinball coverage again. So I've got a couple little minor updates for you there. And I'm sure there's going to be a few more things sneak in by the time the show's over, so stick around. This month we're featuring a brand new contest, the first one since Retro Gaming Radio has been back on the air. And our good friends over at Cloanto, the makers of Amiga Forever and C64 Forever, are donating the prizes. 5 copies of Commodore 64 Forever. C64 Forever is a fantastic package. We've talked about it on the show. It's turnkey, easy legal Commodore 64 emulation. It's fantastic stuff. We've talked about it a million times. In fact, we covered it on the show. And it is absolutely great. You will love having access to this. Even if you're already comfortable and use a Commodore 64 emulator, C64 Forever is a complete turnkey package. It uses their new RP9 or their retro platform library that allow you to take games and build them into this zip type file that contains screenshots and metadata. They've really done a top-notch job with their Forever packages. And most people know we've been using Amiga Forever, well, forever. So, this month, we're going to be starting the new contest, I Heart Commodore 64, 30 years later. This is the anniversary. 1982 is when the Commodore 64 was released. It's 2012. We have 30 years later of Commodore 64 games abound. So, here's all you have to do. List your top five Commodore 64 games in an email. Tell us why you love them, why you played them, and if you still play them. Send the email over to bitsandbytes@retrogamingradio.com, and we will take a look at all the entries. We'll tally them all up. We'll give you the results. Which games were the favorites? Because you know there's going to be duplicates. You know there's going to be some top-notch games that come out of this list. And we'll go over them, myself and Alex J. Lopez. We will go through them. We'll pick the best five reasons, and we will award five copies of Commodore 64 Forever to the five lucky winners. Hey, they're not golden tickets, but what you have is better than golden tickets, the Commodore 64 Forever package. And this, again, is courtesy of Cloanto, AmigaForever.com, C64Forever.com. Remember, we do offer, you do get a discount if you're looking to purchase the packages from Cloanto. They are partners with us in that respect. They give a little discount, a little 10% off type deal for Retro Gaming Radio listeners, and I'm sure Alex will have some links being populated in the HTML5 RGR plus TV player for those of you who are watching it online, and possibly even some video. Maybe he'll chuck some video of C64 Forever in action. Fantastic product. So, I Heart Commodore 64, 30 years later, email five games, your top five Commodore 64 games. Tell us why you love them, why you played them, why you still love them, and we will pick the best five. So, please get those entries in, and we will have the winners announced for the next show. This month's reader mail comes from Brian. Brian says, "Hi, Shane. Just wanted to take the time to thank you and your partner for coming back out with the show. Though I listened to your cast in reverse order, I wanted to do it that way so I could fully appreciate the first episode since 2008. I never forgot about Retro Gaming Radio, and over the years, I've been coming back every few months to see if you wanted to come back. I've always had my suspicions you would because of your deep enthusiasm for the subject of retro gaming. I'm excited to see what the future will bring. Do you have any big interviews planned with anybody from the past? Also, I wanted to ask if the CDs you used to sell with your past archives, do you still have any of those for sale anymore? Thanks again, Shane. Looking forward to the new future casts, Brian." Well, thanks for a nice letter, Brian. We had several come in this month. Very happy to see that a lot of our old listeners are starting to find the show again. And I know we had quite a long hiatus, and so we're very happy that people are rediscovering the show. First up, we do not have any particular interviews planned that we're willing to discuss at this point in time. But rest assured that Retro Gaming Radio is famous for its interviews, and there will continue to be an interview element to the show in the future. We do still have CDs and DVDs. We are not currently selling them on the website right now, but in the very near future, we're going to go ahead and get those back up there and offer those archives once again for those who want the classic episodes. But in the meantime, if you want to hear the classic episodes, we have a 24/7 Shoutcast stream going on right now called Retro Gaming Radio Plus. All of the classic shows of Retro Gaming Radio are there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, constantly being played. Go to shoutcast.com, type in Retro Gaming Radio in the search, and you will get our show 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Get it on your cell phone, get it on your tablet, get it on your mobile devices. The show's available from any Shoutcast streaming client. Compliments of Alex J. Lopez. He does all the work and all the programming for that. So drop him a line and tell him thank you for producing such a fantastic Shoutcast for us. Just keep those letters coming. We read each and every one. Even if we don't read them here on the air, we still read them, and we love them. Keep them coming. For this month's editorial commentary, I would like to take the opportunity to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the greatest era of gaming of all time, 1982. 1982 is a significant red-letter date in the history of gaming. Just like 1955 and Back to the Future was some weird cosmic date in the space-time continuum, in the video game time continuum, 1982 represented the most amazing year of gaming ever. And it didn't matter if you were a console gamer, if you were a computer gamer, if you were an arcade gamer. This was the year that simply made gaming history. And if you look at it, what is gaming really about? It's about the games, right? So listen to this. I've been compiling this list. Alex J. Lopez, my producer, started me off with this list. And I started to realize it's not just what he sent me. There's so much more. So I had to go through my personal collection of arcade gaming history. What did I play? What are some of my favorite games of all time? Were they in 1982 when they came out? And it turned out that a large percentage of my favorite games of all time showed up in 1982. Let me give you a list of arcade games. These aren't all of the arcade games that came out in 1982, but these are the ones that I feel have either some historical significance, like they've been remade a gajillion times, and you could still go down and buy something that plays this exact game right now today, or it had some personal history to me. And we're going to talk about some of these, because this is just crazy, right? Listen to this list. First off, Dig Dug, right? A lot of people, you either loved or hated Dig Dug. I've never met anybody that says, oh, Dig Dug, that's all right. They love Dig Dug or they hate Dig Dug. Me personally, when it came out, I played the crap out of it. It was fantastic. But its significance in history is important because it's still being made. I mean, you still can buy game packs that have Dig Dug on it. It's a property that has lasted a long time. Bagman. I loved Bagman. That was like that. Hardly anybody's ever seen Bagman in the arcade. Maybe you've played a home version like on the Commodore 64. It was actually at the East Wenatchee Rec Center where I worked. They had a Bagman machine. And this was an insane game because it was so hard that it was fun, right? It was so challenging. It was hard. They had so many elements of gaming kind of wrapped up in there. They had sort of a Pac-Man feel. When you pick up a pickaxe, you could go after the guard, but then he'd come back. They had elevators. They had mine cars. I don't know. To me, it was an amazing game that got very little love. That's a Stern game, by the way. Pole Position, of course. Burger Time. Burger Time has stood the test of time. Test of Burger Time. That's been horrid everywhere, and it's still being remade and rehashed and redone now. Donkey Kong Jr., of course. Not, of course, as great as the original Donkey Kong, but it definitely generated some love. Zaxxon. Probably, I'm not positive, but I'd say probably the first 3D perspective game that anybody would remember. There was like iRobot. But how many people have actually seen an iRobot machine? Zaxxon was everywhere. Zaxxon got port after port after port after port. And that was the first time I looked at that and I was like, holy crap, that's like 3D. You know, you actually had to have 3D spatial skills to play Zaxxon. And a lot of people didn't have it, which is why a lot of people didn't like Zaxxon. They couldn't see that three dimension. Who knew that would come in to be the most popular type of gaming later? Qbert, of course. Tron. Oh, my God. This is funny because Tron is not on the list, the original list that I was looking at for 1982 on, I think, Wikipedia or one of the wikis that are out there about video gaming. Tron wasn't on there. How do you dismiss Tron? I mean, Tron's fantastic for a couple of different reasons, right? First of all, it used, I knew as soon as I started talking about it, I wasn't going to remember. Was it RCR graphics? It's the ones that, like, Satan's Hollow used. Domino, the Domino Rally, all of the games right in that era from that particular developer, and of course I don't have any specific notes on that, but Tron was that same type of glowing graphics. It was a little higher resolution. It looked fantastic. And the theme song, of course, it had the music to back it. The arcade cabinet screamed at you when you came into the room, the glowing neon. It was gorgeous, right? Despite the fact that most of the elements of the game that are actually in the game weren't really significant in the movie. Forget about that. That doesn't matter. It's still a great game. And Tron was a 1982 title. Puyan's another one of those games that I absolutely love. I've had it on a million platforms, and it was also one of the weird games that a lot of people haven't seen that was actually at the East Wenatchee Rec Center when I worked there. And it's like, you know, this is Wenatchee, which is no place, right? It's the nowhere town on a nowhere map. And here it is. These weird games like Puyan and Bagman existed at this little arcade that I worked at. It's crazy. Popeye. Right? Who does not love Popeye? Possibly, I'm not positive, but that's one of the very rare third-party licenses that Nintendo made. You know, because Nintendo doesn't own Popeye. That had to be, you know, I think that's King Feature Syndicate that owns that license. But yet Nintendo built a game, a very good game, a beautiful game, on a license they didn't own. It was very strange. Popeye's a great game. It might have been a conversion cab for Donkey Kong, too, which, of course, was helpful in my, you know, poor little town where money was tight. So Popeye, Star Trek Strategic Operations Simulator. I loves me some Star Trek. Star Trek is a vector graphics game that featured an overhead view radar type in one corner, a first-person view in the bottom, and it featured photon torpedoes and warp drive, and it was one of those games that had incredible sound. It had samples of all, it had samples of Spock and Scotty, and it was an action game, right? Up until that point, Star Trek had always been some sort of like a turn-based game. We've all played that Star Trek game where you're in a 9x9 galaxy and each quadrant has X number of star bases and Klingons, right? We've played this, we played Star Trek over and over again as a strategic simulation. But this was like an arcade simulator. How freaking cool is that, right? This, of course, is the year for Williams games. Robotron, Joust, Bubbles. Bubbles is another game no one's ever played, but Bubbles was at the East Wenatchee Rec Center. It's totally crazy. And, of course, the venerable Sinistar was also rounding up that lineup. Also in 1982, one of my favorite arcade games of all time, Time Pilot. Time Pilot was fantastic. It used like a 32-direction joystick or something like 16 or 32, something crazy like that. And that lets you control, of course, a ship in the center of the screen. This is where you didn't see a lot of these type of games. The ship stayed in the center of the screen while everything moved around. It kind of like Bosconian, only with, instead of being four direction, it was like 32 directions. So you had very finite, tight control of your bullets. And it was frantic. And it's a greed game, too. A lot of my favorite games, of course, are greed games. And Time Pilot is all about greed. That's perfect. One of my, and the last arcade game that I've got on the list, this game, to me, has, along with Robotron, has withstood the test of time, for me personally, the longest of any arcade game of all, and that's Mr. Do. I still play Mr. Do. I would say, on the average, you could say I play Mr. Do a couple times a month. Right? I'll fire it up whenever I need something to do, and I don't have any more TV to watch, I don't have any new games on the 3DS to play or on the Android, I will fire up MAME on my tablet and I will throw down Mr. Do. It's a game that I can continue to come back to over and over again. And Mr. Do is a greed game, without question. It's one of the best greed games on the planet. Maybe Zookeeper is more of a greed game than Mr. Do. But overall, Mr. Do has got to be one of the top greed games right up with Robotron. Absolutely fantastic. The best part of Mr. Do is a casual player gets in and out of the game in a couple of minutes, right? You get dead. A lot of people don't know the higher level strategies of how to play Mr. Do. But if you're good at Mr. Do, most arcade games, it doesn't matter how good you are, you're dead in 5 minutes. They want your quarters in, you gone, and the next quarter in as soon as possible. Mr. Do, much like Galaga, if you were good at it and you knew how to play it, you could play Mr. Do for 20 or 30 minutes on a quarter. No problem. And then it gets to a point to where it becomes insane, right? You can play for like 30 minutes, and then all of a sudden the game turns into Satan himself, and you're lucky to live another two rounds. But much like other greed-type games like Pac-Man Championship Edition, that five-minute version of Pac-Man Championship, where essentially you've played the game so much that you're now fine-tuning each level to get the maximum points returned. That's a crazy game. That's a game that it embeds itself into your psyche. And Mr. Do is one of those types of games. Even maybe more so than one of my other top favorites, which would be Robotron. Robotron's all about greed. But Robotron has an element of a bigger element of randomness, where you have strategies for finishing each level, but you don't really have... You can't go back and say, okay, how can I perfect level 7? What could I have done differently? With Mr. Do, it's still random enough to keep you on your toes, but there's definitely a specific set of things you can accomplish on each level based on how many guys there are, how many apples there are. It's a formula. It's a deeper game than what it looks like. Let's put it that way. But listen, the arcade was not the only place that was enjoying unbelievable games in 1982. The Atari 2600, which was at the time still the champion, and some of the games that actually came out are the reasons why it was no longer the champion and why video games in general took a nosedive not very long after 1982. Now, think about your favorite 2600 games, right? Put them on, just mentally start thinking about what would you call your favorite 2600 game. Chances are it came out in 1982. It's crazy. Listen to this list. River Raid, right, from Activision. One of everybody's favorite 2600 games, there it is. Maybe you remember the weird stigma stuff of the 2600. Remember the first porn game that ever came out? Beat 'em and Eat 'em and Custer's Revenge? Both of those games, 1982. Atari 2600 porn games. A lot of people, when you ask them what their favorite era of video gaming is on the Atari 2600, they'll say two names. Activision and Imagic. Both companies were dedicated to making the highest quality games. Activision, of course, had a handful of so many titles you can't even think straight. However, Imagic also had some games everybody loved to play. They were fantastic. Cosmic Arc, Dragonfire, Demon Attack, right? These were all Imagic games that came out in 1982, and these games set the bar for video gaming, right along with Activision. Even Atari themselves weren't making as good of games as Activision and Imagic were. It's funny side story, because I know you guys like these things, and I'm sure I mentioned it on the retro gaming radio like a billion years ago. We have Demon Attack, right? Demon Attack is, in all honesty, a rather unremarkable shooter. You're a little ship at the bottom of the screen, and demons appear flying above you, and you shoot them. There's nothing all that exciting about that game, I'm telling you. But what's funny about that is we were promised a Commodore 64 port. Now, myself and my friend Troy Tulu, of course, he's been the subject of many, many retro gaming radio shows. He and I had been watching magazines, because that's how you found out about new games back then, right? You found out by reading magazines, right? You'd get Computes Gazette, and it would show you ads for the games that were coming out in the next month or two, right? And Demon Attack, we didn't have a 2600, neither one of us. We were computer guys. So it's, oh, Demon Attack, Demon Attack, Demon Attack. And apparently Demon Attack came, and it went, and we never found it. We never saw it. You know, we lived in Wenatchee, for crying out loud. Nobody had it. So I think it was like maybe 2 years later, Troy and I finally dug up a copy. It was a pirated copy, too. We couldn't find the damn original. So we ended up finding a pirated copy of the game finally. And, of course, we played it for like 2 seconds and said, God, we've been waiting 2 years for this. Absolutely crazy. But on the 2600, that was some fantastic gaming. Also in 1982, guess what other – we'll save those for the last, 'cause I got commentary. Pitfall. Pitfall and River Raid kind of walk hand in hand. They're both high-profile Activision games. Of course, Pitfall's David Crane. I don't remember who did River Raid. It might have actually been David Crane. That would not surprise me in the least. Of course, my mind's a little bit foggy on that one. Anyway, so we had Pitfall. Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? Howard Scott Warshaw. right? Made the greatest game of all time for the Atari 2600, being Yar's Revenge. And he was also responsible for the worst game of all time, E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Which, by the way, yes, indeed, E.T. the Extraterrestrial came out in 1982, along with what is often referred to as the start of the downfall of video gaming, which was Pac-Man. Pac-Man on the 2600, this poor guy had like 6 weeks to make it. And let's be honest, the 2600 ain't exactly a powerhouse. And all in all, if you were to look back at Pac-Man, the heart was in the right spot. You know, of course the game doesn't look exactly like the arcade game. Of course it's not going to look like that. Even Ms. Pac-Man, which was more critically acclaimed that came out later, even it didn't really look like the arcade game. But there were some basic things that were missing, right? Pac-Man didn't turn. When he moved up and down instead of right and left, he would turn in the arcade game, right? His mouth would be pointed up or his mouth would be pointed down. Never happened in the 2600 version of Pac-Man, right? We had a huge flickering problem in Pac-Man, right? A lot of emulators actually fix that. So if you were to play Pac-Man now on an emulator, you wouldn't see that every single ghost flickered like mad, which you would if you saw it on the original 2600. A lot of people, Pac-Man, by the way, for those of you not keeping score, was the best-selling 2600 game of all time. However, it also was the most returned video game of all time for the 2600. So while they sold like an unbelievable number back then, like 7 million copies, like 5 million of them were returned or something crazy like that, simply because it, you know, it did not hold up. Pac-Man was, and this is a perfect example of people wanting an arcade translation, but they wanted it as perfect as possible, right? The general public did not believe that Pac-Man on the 2600 was a viable enough alternative to the arcade game. They took Space Invaders, but they didn't take Pac-Man. All interesting information. Also rounding up the 2600 games from 1982, Empire Strikes Back. That was Parker Brothers. And let me tell you something, man. Everybody was playing that game. I don't know what the sales numbers were on Empire Strikes Back. Everybody I know that had a 2600 had Empire Strikes Back. Not just because it was a Star Wars licensed game, but it was actually good. I mean, for those of you who don't remember, it was almost Defender-like, where the world that you were playing on was like 10 times longer than the screen you were looking at. You only got a viewport into like 1/10 of the level. And you would fly the snow speeders to take down AT-ATs, the big giant walking robots from Empire Strikes Back. Those giant, you know, they look like big dogs or whatever people called them back then. They had somebody always, you know, I don't know, those look like big dogs or something. But anyway, so the whole game had you taking down AT-ATs. It was brilliant. It was so fast, and it was so clean. It was brilliant. The AT-AT's walk was realistic. It was fantastic. Everybody was playing Empire Strikes Back, 1982. And lastly, rounding out the great 2600 game list of 1982, Haunted House, which even today has been remade, rewritten, rehashed, and redone. It's a game that has withstood the test of time. But what about the other consoles? What about those guys? Well, there were several things that were also very good on other consoles as well. Probably the most memorable one to me would be on the Intellivision, which was the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons game. Unfortunately, the license to that game was lost. So when you see it nowadays in emulation packages and various locations, you'll notice that it's not called Advanced Dungeons & Dragons anymore. They lost that license. But it's the same game. Here's a great story for you. The TV show out about at that point in time was a show called The Greatest American Hero. Now, I'm a huge fan. Anybody who's followed me for years knows I've talked very fondly about The Greatest American Hero. In one of the episodes, and of course I didn't write this down, but you can find it easy enough, there's a guy that's really good at video games. And he's playing a game in a cabinet at the arcade. It looks, if I remember right, it's a Tempest cabinet, the game Tempest. It uses, but it has a joystick and a fire button on the control panel because they zoom in on the control panel to show somebody playing. But on the actual screen, they are showing Advanced Dungeons and Dragons from the Intellivision. It's too funny. It's worth looking just to see that piece of the episode. You know, people don't spend a lot of time recreating video game sounds or making things accurate for video games and TV and movies. This one was definitely the worst one I've ever seen in terms of mix matching as much as possible. Let's move on to computer stuff, though, right? Because let's put it this way. I was a computer guy, and the Commodore 64 came out in 1982, and along with it, several fantastic games. Now, some of these games came out for other computers, too. Atari 400 or 800, whichever was out at the time. Sinclair also released the ZX Spectrum in the UK back in, I think, April of 1982. That's significant to a lot of my UK games. And some of these actually appeared on Atari's second gaming console, the Atari 5200, that came out later in that year as well. But let's go over some of the great things that came out for the Commodore 64 and for other computers, too. Choplifter, right? We just saw a remake of Choplifter come out for, I believe, consoles for Xbox Live and for PlayStation Network, right? So Choplifter's alive and well. Fantastic game. That's Broderbund, which, by the way, Broderbund put out some of the greatest stuff, right? I think half this list comes from Broderbund. David's Midnight Magic, fantastic pinball game. Unbelievable physics for a Commodore 64. That one I know got ported to, or was ported from the 64 from other platforms. Ford Apocalypse. I still play Ford Apocalypse today. Insanely hard game, but insanely satisfying game. Miner 2049, or 2049, or however you pronounce it. Miner 2049 came out on pretty much every 8-bit platform possible. And I love that game. Fantastic game. Chutes and Ladders with toxic monsters. You gotta love that. Paratrooper was a game that came out not as a commercial entity, but there were ports of Paratrooper on various platforms. On the Commodore 64, I believe it was called Paratrooper. On the Apple II, which we had at school, right, because Apple product dumped so many Apples into schools, everybody had them, it came out as Sabotage. And when we would sneak into the Computer Resource Center and we were playing Apple II video games we weren't supposed to, probably on pirated discs too, Sabotage was one of our old-time favorites. Stellar 7 came out for various platforms. That was crazy on the Commodore 64. Essentially, it was Battlezone on steroids. Telengard, right? A lot of people, including my first real, what I would consider an RPG, was Telengard from Avalon Hill. And they later became SSI, I think. Strategic Simulations Incorporated or something. But Telengard was hours. I mean, When we talk about marathon gaming sessions where you would literally play for 8-10 hours straight and you would take turns playing and all that stuff, Telengard was one of those games. Fantastic. And I've got to give special props to a game that almost made me buy a second computer, right? Now, back this at this point in time, you're talking about $400-$600 for a basic home computer like the Commodore 64. So buying another computer when you had one already, ludicrous, right? Nobody owned one of everything back then, not like it is today. The TI-99-4A, Texas Instruments computer, it was kind of like the TRS-80. It almost even looked like a TRS-80, but very few people had one. I had one friend that had one. See, that was kind of cool. The idea back in those days when I was a teen was you wanted different people to have different platforms so you could go to their house and play it. A lot of my friends were C64 people, but I did have an Atari person. It was in my network. I had a ColecoVision friend, and I had one guy that had a TI-99-4A. He moved. So the only thing I ever got to look at on it was a game called Parsec. And if you were to go and Google Parsec, you'll find the game has a huge following. So it wasn't just me. Parsec actually made me think maybe I need to have a TI-99-4A computer. It was just that great of a game. That also came out in 1982. What else? Just to give you an idea, 82 was a great year, not just for gaming, but for other stuff too. And let me just give you a little bit of memory jolt, shall we? In addition, of course, to the Sinclair and the Commodore 64 and the 5200 being released in 1982, the little show known as Starcade, a video game show, came out at the very tail end of 1982. Epcot at Disney World opened in 1982. I remember when Epcot opened. It's in my memory bank as something that was pertinent and huge. When Epcot opened, it was huge. Rich people went to Epcot, right? The rich people that I knew in my friends list went to Epcot. I finally got to go to Epcot in late 87 or early 88 as part of training in Orlando for the military. That was my, for those of you who've been in the military, you have an 8-week boot camp, right? And on your 6th or 7th weekend, you got something called unsupervised, you had a supervised weekend out and then an unsupervised weekend out where everyone had to go to the same place for the supervised one, and they had, you know, company commanders and stuff running all over the place. And then they had an unsupervised one, which is a little more laid back. And I believe that's when I went to Epcot. I can't remember. Boy, that was a long time ago. But Epcot was a huge thing in the early 80s. What about Michael Jackson's Thriller? Remember way back when Michael Jackson was alive and black? Well, that was Michael Jackson of my day, of 1982, when Thriller came out. That was huge, right? The video came out of Thriller. They played it on MTV like every hour on the hour. It was a 17 or 22-minute video directed by John Landis, who just made American Werewolf in London. And here's Michael Jackson wolfing out and freaking out. It was fantastic, right? That was a huge period piece of that 1982 time frame. If you were in the arcade, and arcades typically had jukeboxes, Michael Jackson's Thriller was probably the album you were playing Robotron to. And, of course, the year rounded out with the 2600 releasing E.T. the Extraterrestrial, which by most standards, I mean, researchers all agree, E.T. on the 2600 began the fall of the video gaming era, which only a year and a half later, came tumbling to a crash. E.T. the Extraterrestrial was such a horrific failure that they were actually taking carts and they were burying them in landfills. You can actually Google this. We've talked about this before. But these things were in such surplus, they made so many of them because E.T. was so huge that, like Pac-Man, they didn't figure that that property could fail. E.T. was done by Howard Scott Warshaw, and I have an interview with him in the Classic Retro Gaming Radio Collection where he talks all about E.T. the Extraterrestrial, what happened, why it was what it was. So if you have access to those, I would definitely recommend going back and listening to the archives, because the Howard Scott Warshaw interviews are probably some of the best stuff that I've ever aired on the show. To round up this 30th anniversary look, I wanted to share with you, the Commodore 64 was the 80s to me. Right, the Amiga came out later. I didn't get an Amiga until like 1989. The majority of my 80s life, my most important years, my impressionable years, high school, junior high school, middle school, whatever, I lived on my Commodore 64. 8, 10 hours a day, 12 hours a day. I played games on it. I programmed on it. I played music on it. I did everything with that unit. And so it's a near and dear thing to my heart. And so I picked out my 15 greatest memories of the Commodore 64. It started off as 10, but I overshot. I think there might actually be more than 15 on here, but you'll have to put up with it. So maybe it's like my 16 greatest memories of the Commodore 64. And these are in no particular order, by the way, but I'm going to share these with you. Some of these I have covered on previous shows. Some of them I have not, but we'll try to keep it shorter. The first memory of the Commodore 64, as most people will tell you, is the smell. I have never, ever smelled anything quite like opening a Commodore 64. There's a distinctive smell associated when you cracked open a Commodore 64 box and opened it. It was a combination of the styrofoam and the plastic manufacturing. It was something, but believe me, you ask any Commodore 64 person, and I guarantee you they will remember 30 years later what the Commodore 64 smelled like when you opened it. So that's my first greatest memory of the 64. Next up, Legacy of the Ancients, right? I've covered this extensively on more than one show. As far as I'm concerned, Legacy of the Ancients to me was my first real experience outside of Telengard, right? Telengard was the first, really. But Legacy of the Ancients to me represents the epitome of what great role-playing games should be like. There's level building, there's character building, there's statistical building, there's a story that is compelling, but not so intrusive that it interferes with the game. The story concept was insane, right? Essentially, the concept revolved around this ancient race of people. They went from planet to planet and put up museums for their kind. When they visited each planet, they would have some place to go to learn about the natives and the culture, to get weapons and money, that sort of thing, so they could be tourists on these planets. So it was like a tourist center, right? But they were built around these museums. So you awaken in this strange land, and you find your way into this museum. And in this museum, you start learning about this land that you're in. They start you off with some money at a money exhibit. You know, this is the currency of the realm. Here's $200 in currency. You know, here's a weapons display. This is a crude knife, but it's effective. As a museum patron, you can borrow it for as long as you want. And the museum had a caretaker, right? He's the guy that handled your leveling process, right? So he would send you out on quests, he would communicate with you, and he would tell you various things that need to be done. And when you were ready to level up, when things were good for you, and you completed quests and whatnot, there's like this little, there's a phrase that gets used, and it still kind of gives me shivers a little bit. You get a little note that pops up in this text box at the bottom that says, "The caretaker wants to see you." And anytime the caretaker wants to see you, there's some good stuff going to happen. Usually it's to level you up. And that increased all your stats. It gave you more health. It made you more powerful. Legacy of the Ancients to me was a brilliant, and a lot of people say, oh, well, it's like Ultima and all that stuff. But listen, it was like Ultima on steroids back at that time. The Commodore 64 version was far and away the best version. The IBM version looked like, well, let's say it looked like hammered crap, all right? The sound effects, the flickering of the torches in the museum, it was an insane game. And even today, I wish somebody would port the engine and give us a new adventure using this platform, because I loved it that much. Next up, Sid Player. Sid Player, and I'm not talking about Sid Music. That's something different. A lot of people confuse like High Voltage Sid Collection and all these other things with the actual term Sid Player. Sid Player was made by Craig Chamberlain. Nice guy, by the way. I got a hold of him, I don't know, about 10 years ago, and he answered my email, and I gave him a lot of praise and kissed his butt a little bit. Sid Player was a Compute Gazette licensed program. You actually had to pay for this, even though it came from Compute Gazette magazine. And you would purchase the editor. It's called Sid Edit, I think, was the name of it. And using that, you would make Sid Player files. Sid Player music at .sid files would play on an actual on-screen piano. And it was fantastic. When you wanted to show off how great your Commodore 64 is, you loaded up Sid Player and you played Sid music. You played Sid files. This went in line with Quantum Link. Quantum Link was the early AOL. AOL actually was Quantum Link. A lot of the things that you see, like People Connection that were in AOL, that stems from the original Quantum Link days. This was back when there was no real internet, right? So it's not like, oh, you used AOL, that's gross. Yeah, well, there wasn't anything else, all right? That was it. That was all there was. You had some local BBSs you could call, and then you had an online service, and that was it, Quantum Link. And it was cool. It was all visual and graphic, and they had games you could play and all that kind of crap. I mean, this was a long time ago. This is 1982, 83, right? Way back when Quantum Link was started. I still have a disc of Quantum Link, a sign-up kit. So, anyway, so back to Sid Player. Quantum Link was a file repository, too. So you had hundreds. I wouldn't say thousands. You had hundreds of professional music composers kicking out the most amazing Sid music ever on Sid Player. And you can get to that repository, too. I got a link that I'm going to send to you if you're on the RGR Plus TV player. I'm going to send you guys a link that'll take you right to a huge collection of this Quantum Link Sid Player music. And you can play that music, with a native PC app. So you don't have to actually run a Commodore 64 to do it. But it's fun to see. My next favorite memory of the Commodore 64 was bypassing a protection dongle with a paperclip. Access Software came out with the greatest games on the Commodore 64. They were responsible for Beachhead, Beachhead 2, Raid Over Moscow. What was the other big game they did? 10th Frame Bowling, the best bowling game ever. And they were the first ones that I've ever even heard of that came out with a hardware protection dongle. What this was a little piece of plastic. This is how they combated piracy. You took a little piece of plastic and you plugged it into the tape port, the cassette tape port on the back of the Commodore 64. You plug that in and then the game would run. If it wasn't in, you didn't play, right? Well, some of us who still had tape drives laying around, we also found out that what this dongle did was simulate pressing play on the cassette tape. So if you did it right, you could actually plug a cassette player in, you know, a Commodore 64 data set. You could plug that in, and at the right time, you could press play on the tape. If you did it too early, it wouldn't work. You'd press play on the tape, it would bypass the protection, so you could play a pirated copy if you had a tape drive, which is totally bizarre. And then it's like, well, what does that actually do? So I was reading the Commodore 64 technical manual, not the one that came with it, but that really cool programmer's reference guide. And pressing play on tape really didn't do anything but essentially bridge two pins on the tape port. Pins 1 and 2, I think it was. So I'm thinking, well, that's all it really has to be, right? All you have to do is bridge those two pins. And that's probably what the dongle did. It had a little pin bridger. That was it. So I took a paper clip and clipped over the two pins to short them together. Bing. I was now able to play all of Access's software that used the hardware protection dongle with a paper clip. That still remains with me today. Quantum Link was also host to my next thing, the Digital Dan sound files. Digital Dan, good luck finding anything on these guys. I looked and I looked and I looked, and you, if I didn't know, if I wasn't 100% convinced, I would say that Digital Dan was a figment of my imagination. Somebody created a hardware digitizer, an audio digitizer, a sound sampler, called Digital Dan. Obviously, the guy's name was probably Dan. Word on the street at the time was there were like five people that had one of these because he made them by hand. He never sold them. So if you actually owned one of these things, you were basically God. What this would let you do, get this, it would let you sample about 13 seconds of course, 8-bit, but high-quality audio, right? It used every single ounce of the Commodore 64's memory. You actually had to shut the machine off or do a hard reset after you were done with it, because it literally overwrote everything that the Commodore 64 had in memory to make it work. And it would play, it was either 7 or 13, I don't know why both of those numbers are in my head, but it would play high quality pieces of music. Now, obviously people digitized what was available at the time. Here are the ones that I remember getting. First of all, these things were like 202 blocks, right? A full floppy disk. No, it wasn't a full floppy disk, because that'd be bigger than memory. They were huge. They were the biggest files that I'd ever gotten off Quantum Link. And you're talking about hours of paid time, right? When you downloaded files, you were on pay time. So when you downloaded one of these music samples, it was literally like a two-hour download. And you were paying, you know, what, 25 cents a minute, whatever, for that? That ends up being a lot of money at the end of the month. These things were huge for 7 seconds of digital audio. Some of the songs that I did have, that I did get, were The Final Countdown from Europe. Laura Branigan, Self-Control, and there was one other one that just slipped out of my head the second I started talking about it. But there were like four or five of them that were out there that I remember seeing, but I'm sure somebody posted more. Digital Dan, something I would love to have more information on. It's not on Wikipedia. You're not going to find it anywhere. If you happen to remember something about it, I'd love to talk to you about it, or especially if you had one, I'd love to have more information about exactly what it was, because there really isn't any information about that anywhere on the internet, which is bizarre because everything else is documented but that. Floppy disks, right? Those people who have never been raised with floppy disks, you don't really understand. Floppies, 5 1/4 inch floppy disks were it's a piece of history, right? You watch like War Games, and he has like 8-inch floppies that he puts in that Akai disk drive. Well, these were smaller versions of that, right? They were 5 1/4 inches. Those of you who were on the old IBM days, you probably remember those. Not those little 3.5-inch disks that you could still buy today. These were full-blown floppy disks. When you said floppy, they were actually floppy. You could wiggle them in your hand, and they would bend. And they were basically just a little piece of thin plastic with a magnetic coating inside of a protective black housing. Right, there was a little tiny read window that the read write heads could read on the disk, and a hub in the middle that the mechanism would actually clamp down on the center of this ring and spin the disk inside. So it was like a phonograph record. Okay, wait a minute. So maybe you don't know what a phonograph record is. Like a CD. It's like a CD, right? CDs spin when they play. Same thing with the floppy disk, right? So what's funny is floppy disks came in single and double-sided, right? So you could write to one side of the disk or read. You know, games came on a floppy disk, and some games came on 2 floppy disks. Occasionally, you would get a game that came on a flipper, which would be a game on one side, maybe a data disk on the back side, right? So you could actually take these out and flip them. Well, most floppy disks were certified for writing on one side only. In other words, the factories that made these things came out with a certification that said, okay, we omni-domni this as high-quality elephant memory or whatever it was, right? We think that this is high enough quality to get our stamp on it, right? Well, the backside of the disk was coated in magnetic particles too. So if you knew how to do it, you could use both sides of a single-sided disk, saving yourself however much it was. The floppy disks were back then, 1¼ a piece, something like that. So they had this, essentially, there's a little notch in the side of the disk, and if you ever see pictures of these things, you'll see a little notch. That was a write protect notch. So if that notch was open, the floppy disk drive could write to it. If you put a piece of tape around it, a write protect strip, they called it, then the disk couldn't be written to anymore. The data was safe. There was no way that it could be written to. The switch, right? Memory cards have these same little slider things on them now where you can stop them from being written to. Same thing. We found out that if you put a write protect hole on the other side of the disk, you could write to the back side too. It was like one of the monumentous occasions. But you had to put the hole in the right spot, right? So people used a hole punch. Some people used an X-Acto knife. Eventually, some smart person came up with a dedicated floppy disk puncher. It was like a hole puncher, but it was perfectly sized and aligned to make a perfectly square, notched hole right on the side of the disk that you needed it to be. And it worked every time. I remember when colored floppy disks came out, right? Floppy disks were always black. I mean, right now, nowadays, everything's got colors, right? Everything's color-based. Back in the old days, floppy disks were black. That was just the way it was. Just like tires are black. What if you saw a car driving around with white tires? You'd be impressed, right? They'd be like, oh, that's kind of different. Well, somebody actually came out with a colored floppy disk. I don't know why they didn't come out with it sooner, but the first floppy disk I ever saw that was colored was a copying package called Disk Maker. And chasing copy protection, too, with floppy disks was insane. We've talked about that on other shows. But that was another piece of the Commodore 64 memory. But floppy disks in general are huge in my memory banks. Ice Pick, right? We talked about the Ice Pick. Ice Pick was the first commercial hacking tool that actually snapshotted your entire memory of the Commodore 64, right? So let's say you had a game. Most games had some sort of a protection on the disk, right? You would load the game. And somewhere during the loader, it would check a particular spot on the disk, or it would try to validate something. Maybe it had type-in protection, right? You loaded up a game and it said, enter word 7 of line 12 of paragraph 2 on page 237 of the manual. So if you didn't have the manual, you couldn't type in the word, you couldn't play the game, so piracy was thwarted, right? Well, here's the thing. If you were past the protection check, if you could just snapshot the memory and reload that, there'd never be a worry about the protection check happening, right? So let's say you had, I think Hillsfar, some of the Dungeons and Dragons games had a type-in protection, right? Before the game even started, type-in protection. So you would load the game, typing your protection, right, from a code wheel or from the manual. You'd hit enter. It would jump to the title screen. Bam, you flip the little switch on this ice pick cartridge. At that point in time, it would actually copy the entire contents of memory to a floppy disk. And you could reload that and immediately start where you left off. Now, this was like a 45-minute process, right? I mean, and that's if it worked. Not all the, it wouldn't always work, right? The developers got smart, and they started figuring out ways of making it not work. But it was like 45 minutes or something each time you tried to snapshot the memory. But when it worked, it was flawless, right? So you borrow your friend's copy of Hillsfar. You brought the manual and the disk home. You loaded it up. You got past the protection check. And as soon as the title screen came up, flip the switch. 45 minutes later, you had a copy of Hillsfar that would boot straight up with no copy protection. And if the game accessed the disk again later, you would just have a copy of the disk, right? It didn't matter if the copy protection wasn't on the disk or not. You already bypassed the protection check. So you'd have a double-sided flipper floppy, right? On the front side would be the ice pick crack memory dump. And then when it was time to play the game, you'd flip the disk over and it would read the data files or whatever it needed. Ice pick was insane. It was the very first one of its kind, and it was duplicated a gajillion times after that. Ice Pick was an amazing piece of technology. My next favorite memory, MLX, Machine Language Editor. I don't know why X came, means editor. Maybe MLE was copyrighted or something. Computes Gazette started putting binary machine language games in their magazine. Well, they had code that you would type in these magazines, right? They would produce, you know, here's a new game, Caves of Ice, right? They would actually print the program listings in BASIC in the back of these magazines. You plop the magazine up and typed in the code. That's how I learned how to program in BASIC, was fixing stupid magazine game discs, you know, game entries, right? Well, they wanted to offer fast arcade action machine language games. Well, that really wasn't typing in BASIC anymore. That was long series of binary numbers, right? Well, they came up with something called MLX. Normally what you would do is you would write about in data statements, right? You would say, you know, 10, you know, low, you know, 4, 0, you know, 4T equals 0 to 255, read data, poke data into memory, and repeat, right? That's how they originally did machine language. Well, say, well, that's too hard. I mean, people are misentering numbers, right? You have to enter 10,000 numbers, right? Three-digit numbers, like 10,000 of them. How the hell could you do that with any sort of accuracy, right? So they came up with MLX. So you would enter a string of like 8 numbers into this editor, and then you would enter a checksum number. If they didn't match, they made you enter the line again. So essentially, it was a bulletproof way of letting consumers type in 10,000 frickin' numbers, and when you were done, it would save the file off as, you know, an executable, and boom, you now had a machine language, you know, high quality thing that actually ran the way it was supposed to. No accidental twitches or wrong variables typed in or whatever. It was a great tool. I spent so many hours with MLX. We did it as a tag team. I bet you guys did it too. Troy would come over and I would start entering numbers, and you just did this blindly, right? You got good at it. There was no 10 key, by the way. So 10 key would have helped a lot. But you know, it's like, you know, Troy would sit there and be going line for line, 036, 254, 012, 127, 33, you know, 33 or 033, right? And then next line, next line, next line, next line. We worked hard to play games when I was a kid. Let me put it that way. So MLX is a huge memory. The VIC modem, my very first modem, 300 baud, which there's no way that I can equate that to a broadband user, right? A broadband user, dial-up, right? A lot of people that are on broadband now did dial-up. Well, you probably had 56K modems. I don't think there was anything less towards the end of that era, right? 56K modems, maybe 28.8 modems. Yeah, that's 28.8K. This was 300, no K. That's how slow it was. Let me explain to you just how this is. Remember when you had dial-up, okay, and somebody picked up the extension phone in your house, and it would be like, you know, this horrible, nasty, screeching computer sound, and it all sounded like gibberish. You couldn't hear anything, right? I mean, all you heard was computers screaming at you. In 300 baud days, if somebody picked up the extension phone and you were connected and you were typing, they could hear each keystroke going across the line. That's how slow it was. And as a bonus, it wouldn't even dial the damn phone for you. What the hell? You actually had to do this. Okay, this is, I swear, this is God's own truth. First of all, modems had two modes, originate and answer. And when you had a modem probably, in the, you know, right before the internet, right before broadband came out, it would know based on whether you sent it a signal to tell it to dial or whether the phone was ringing. It knew whether it should be an answer or originate. On the VIC modem, it was a hard switch. You actually had to flip the switch, right? Crazy. Not only that, on old modems, on newer modems, you plugged it into the wall, and then you plugged your phone into the modem. It had a pass-through, right? No, not on the VIC modem. Here's what happened when you wanted to call a BBS or, you know, call a friend or whatever on your computer. You picked up your phone, you dialed the number, and as soon as the phone started ringing, you had to unplug the handset. You know the little curly wire that goes up to the handset? You had to quickly unplug that and get that plug into the VIC modem before the phone realized it and hung up. That was the internet in 1982. Well, actually, that'd be more like probably 83, 84. But you get the idea. If you have broadband, kiss somebody right now. You call your internet service provider and say, thank you, that I don't have to actually take my phone apart to get on the internet. Oh, teleclone, teleclone, teleclone. Back in the old days, in the early 80s, a guy working for the Texas Phone Company, a Texas Phone Company, had some sort of a beef with the phone company. He worked there, they pissed him off, he left. Well, unfortunately, he took a lot of knowledge when he left. Knowledge about how phone boxes worked. When I say boxes, I'm talking about the types of tones and sounds used to control the phone system. This guy, I'm sure he had friends, this guy came up with something called teleclone. It was the first and most popular, as I recall, phone freaking device. This guy took all of the knowledge he had of the phone company and stuffed it into this Commodore 64 program called teleclone. What could you do with teleclone? Teleclone, now here's an interesting piece of information. At the time, the Commodore 64 was the only computer that could do three-tone sound. Okay? So it requires, get this, when you push a button on your phone to dial and you hear that beep, boop, boop, beep, boop, those sound effects require three voices to make. You can't do it with two voices, and you can't make it with one voice. It requires distinctive three tones, or three patterns to make each tone. So the Commodore 64 was absolutely perfect for this. It was able to recreate every single tone required by the phone company to do things as if you were an operator. So get this. So you could actually use teleclone. This is how I used it. I will admit I was an underage minor at the time, but, what's the statute of limitations on this? Essentially, here's how it worked. You dialed an 800 number, and according to the documentation and whatnot, 800 numbers are basically ignored. Once the call is put through, right, as soon as the call goes through, the people that own the 800 number, something about visibility. I'm a little foggy. This was like 30 friggin' years ago. Essentially what it was, 800 numbers were perfect to call because the phone company didn't watch them very close. 800 numbers were, I think back then they paid a flat fee for 800 numbers, right? So if I was, you know, Exxon and I had an 1-800 number to call, I paid the phone company $5,000 a month or whatever, and I could have pretty much as many calls as I wanted. So when the 800 number was connected, the phone company just stopped tracing it. There was no, it was like, it's an 800 number. We don't need to know, right? Crazy, but true. Anyway, so you called an 800 number, and it didn't matter if it was busy or whether it rang forever. Nobody had to be at the other end. As soon as the call clicked through, you could send a 2600 hertz tone into the mouthpiece of the phone. That was some sort of an operator tone. Like, if you called the operator and said, hey, I need you to place a call for me, right? The operator uses tones to control the phone line. So the operator tone, the 2600 hertz tone, would open the line. Now, if it was busy or it was ringing, whatever, all of a sudden it went blank. You had this beep, and then the phone line was empty. At that point in time, you could send a code that says, I want to place a call. Here's the number. Now send the call request. Next thing you know, you were talking to somebody in freaking Europe. You were talking to somebody in Spain. You were talking to somebody across the United States. And nobody was being billed for the call. The 800 people already paid their dues. So they, you know, they weren't getting a bill at the end of the month. You weren't charging somebody's credit card or hacking somebody's account. You were doing what was called blue boxing. Blue box was the tones that were required to make a phone call. So I did a little bit of that. There were also other boxes, silver boxes, red boxes, that would control other aspects of the phone lines. One box promised that you could send tones to pay phones. Now, pay phones had already gone through a renovation where a lot of these boxes didn't work. But I had heard reports, and it could be complete BS, but I had heard reports that people were successfully using these boxes in rural areas where the phone system had not been improved yet. Big metropolitan areas, of course, they had been. But what would happen is a friend of yours would go to a phone booth, and they would call you with, you know, they put a quarter in or a dime or whatever it was back then, and they'd call you. You would then take your phone, hold it up to the Commodore 64 speakers, and play a particular tone. Based on the tone, it would crap out a quarter, a nickel, or a dime, just like a refund that an operator would give you, right? Because back then, you could hit zero from any phone booth, call the operator and say, hey, listen, you know, I just put a quarter in and wouldn't make the call. And she would issue you a 25-cent refund. Well, using a silver box or red box, one of those two, you could actually send that sound effect to the phone that would trigger the phone to drop a quarter out. Now, I never did that. I did not engage in activity that would cost anybody money. But I figured, you know, like most criminals do, I figured that blue boxing was a victimless crime, which it kind of was, right? I mean, I wasn't going to make those calls if I couldn't get them for free anyway, much like piracy, right? A lot of people say that piracy costs money. Well, most people who were pirating software wouldn't have bought it anyway. So anyway, I've told that story a million times, but I love talking about Teleclone and all the stuff. Now, you couldn't get away with that for very long. That only lasted like a year. And then all of the companies started getting some sort of electronic sound sensing, ESS. Oh, boy, the memories are way back on that one. But they started getting inline detectors where they could detect that. And I knew at least one guy like in Titusville, Florida, that I had some association with. Essentially, they caught on, and they let him sit there and rack up bills all month. They let him run that phone all month long. Then sent his parents a $5,000 bill. Needless to say, they weren't pleased with that. But at least he didn't go to jail. Speaking of telecommunication software, one of my fondest memories of the Commodore 64 was something called Sixth Sense. Not the movie, of course. Sixth Sense was a terminal software. Maybe you used Procom in the past if you were a PC user. There were tons of telecommunication software for calling bulletin boards. Sixth Sense was the absolute best. It was written by a guy named Rick Sterling, which someday I hope to meet because this guy's a genius. Sixth Sense was the greatest terminal software on the planet. Mostly because not only was it fast, beautiful, and elegant, it had macros, right? Logging into BBS sucked, right? Because you logged into the BBS, usually you had to hit a control C to stop the BBS's intro from streaming in, and then it would get, you'd have to log in with a login name and a password, and then it would prompt you, do you want to see your new messages? Do you want to look at this? Do you want to do, so you had to answer like a whole bunch of stuff before you could actually use the damn thing. Well, Sixth Sense let you make macros. So the macros could determine if something came in and what to do if that happened. Sort of like filtering on your email, right? You know, when you saw the word BBS, like the first thing that would stream in at the top of the thing was, welcome to so-and-so BBS. That's when you'd hit Control C to break out of that video, well, not video, but the intro screen of the bulletin board. So you'd hit Control C. Well, you set up Sixth Sense to have a macro that said, when that BBS showed up, hit Control C and then be done. Next time BBS showed up, don't do that. So then it would then it would pass it to the next macro. When the name username came up, type in, you know, Dark Uni. When the password comes up, type in password. When you see the if you see the phrase new messages, hit Y for yes. Or if you don't, wait for this prompt so you would hit 1. So Sixth Sense had the most amazing macro system I've ever seen. And it had something called virtual buffering. I know this goes way back. We're in an era where we have scroll bars. Scroll bars didn't exist back then, folks. When something went off the screen, it was gone. When something scrolled off the screen, it was gone, folks. Well, Procom and a lot of other terminal software had something called a buffer, right? So it would have like an 8K buffer where if something scrolled off and you're like, oh crap, I really needed that, you could hit like Control L or something like that or Control B and it would bring up a new window that would show you the buffer that it had captured. Huge pain in the butt. Sixth Sense had something called a virtual buffer. So it was a wraparound deal, right? So it had like an 8K buffer, but you could scroll up and down. Just like a web page, right? If let's say that something could scroll off the screen, you could hold down the control key or shift or something and hit the up arrow and it would slide the screen back upwards. I know this sounds like nothing in 2012, but in 1983 or whatever, this was the greatest thing you'd ever seen. What? I don't have to go look at a buffering log. I can just scroll backwards and it would roll over, right? So it would fill up 8K and then it would start destroying the oldest stuff that was in your buffer. So literally it would just sit there and roll. You didn't have to reset anything it was insane. Suffice to say that Rick Sterling made my day. Turns out Rick Sterling also made another one of my great memories, The Entertainer, right? I'm not a ragtime music fan, right? But I kind of like the song The Entertainer. Rick Sterling created a version of The Entertainer in BASIC. It was a BASIC program that would actually make music. It would play The Entertainer in three voice, harmonious. It was fantastic, right? Well, somebody improved that and came up with a way to make it even sound better. What they did is, I don't even know the complexities of it, but it was still in BASIC, right? It wasn't machine language, so it was slow. You would load up this program. It was a program. You'd load it up. It wasn't a SID file or anything. You load it up and you would run it and it would basically say, take a break, you got 3.5 minutes. Come back in 3.5 minutes. And it would sit there and it would shove music into large arrays inside the computer. At the end of 3.5 minutes, it would finally play. And it was the best version of The Entertainer I've ever heard. It was fantastic, it was great, it was phenomenal. And then when it was over, you could play it again without having to redo it. Well, over time, people have come up with ways of avoiding having to do that, right? They read it into a SID file, and they stash it as that, and now you don't have to wait 3.5 minutes. But it took me the better part of 10 years to find a copy of this. And I do have it. I'm going to share it with you, my listeners. Whether or not it's playing in the background right now, maybe Alex will do that for you. It might be playing in the background right now, and you could pause the show and turn the volume up on the audio. I'll provide links and stuff for it too, where you can download it and play it yourself. I captured it as an MP3, and there's the video that Alex is probably playing is available on YouTube. You can watch it. But The Entertainer was huge, and it turned out that Rick Sterling was the guy behind the original arrangement of that. Some other guy did the new arrangement and did some stuff and whatnot to it, but Rick Sterling gets credit for it. It's fantastic. The other greatest thing I remember about Commodore 64, most of my memories have to do with sound, right? And Skate or Die from Electronic Arts wasn't the greatest game. I'm not going to lie to you. But Skate or Die had one thing that was absolutely insane. The frickin' title screen music. These guys managed to squeeze a fourth voice out of the Commodore 64. I don't know how they did it. Even David Thiel, which you heard his interview, or you heard the first part of his interview. I don't record the show in order, folks, all right? You're going to hear more about David Thiel and some of his exploits here later in the show. Even David Thiel hadn't heard about this, and he's like this mastermind of Commodore 64 sound. He was impressed, and he's hard to impress. I sent him that intro, and I said, how about this? Have you ever heard of this? What's the technology behind this? And he says, I don't know how they pulled the fourth voice off, but it's amazing. Hats off to him. It's an amazing piece. Essentially, it's a three-voice music file, but they have a digitized guitar that plays riffs over the top. It's fantastic. I've got a link for you. I don't know how Alex is going to present it to you, but it's fantastic, man. And I've looked at all the other versions of Skate or Die. None of them are quite as good as this intro. So I remember that. I used to just load that game, just listen to the music, and then shut it off. No, it's true. It's true. Load Runner, creating levels in Load Runner. That Troy and I, boy, I'll tell you what. Load Runner was incredible. First of all, Troy ran 3 miles. I did not keep up as well. I wasn't fat back then, though. But Troy and I, you know, we didn't have a car. We were like, what, 14 or whatever. So we ran all the way across town to Payless. Was it Payless? God, I don't remember. I know where the store was. Suffice to say, though, Troy ran to the store, bought Load Runner on cartridge, and ran back, and I ran back with him. For the next, like, 48 hours, that's all we did, was build levels for Load Runner. Well, first of all, we played the crap out of it, and then we fired up the editor, and he would make levels while I slept. Then when I woke up, I would play his levels while he slept, build some levels for him to play, wash, rinse, and repeat. That's what I did as a kid. You wonder how I turned out this way, right? Troy is also the main focal point of many of my Commodore 64 memories. He created a program called Inquisitor. There was educational software out there, but it wasn't really high quality educational software. Troy wanted a test generator. He wanted something that would create tests, like almost like a sort of electronic flashcardish, but it had like multiple choice and all sorts of other cool stuff. He created this program on the Commodore 64 called Inquisitor. Both Troy and I used that for schoolwork, for actual use. Funny story, though, Troy ended up going to Cashmere High School later on in our high school career, and I went to Wenatchee High School. I took a basic programming class, I believe my junior year, and let me tell you something, I knew a lot more than anybody else in that class, including the instructor. So essentially, I ran the class. I knew more. These were Apple IIs, which, you know, 6502, basic was pretty close. So we were supposed to do a final project for the basic class. My final project, I ported over Inquisitor to the Apple II. And, you know, Troy did such a great job. It was even usable. I mean, usually when you write software at like 15 or 16 years old, it works maybe, but it ain't the prettiest thing. It may not be the most usable thing. Troy created a truly brilliant piece of software. And even on the Apple II, I could not perfectly recreate just how great it was. And what's really sad is I don't think in either version exists anywhere anymore. No internet, no real, I mean, we might have uploaded it to QuantumLink, but QuantumLink's gone. But yeah, Inquisitor was huge, huge, huge memory. And then lastly, the Action Replay cartridge. Action Replay was the big brother to the Ice Pick. We talked about the Ice Pick earlier. One of the other things that most people would remember from the Commodore 64 is something called Fast Load. Epix, who created great games at the time, created a cartridge called the Fast Load cartridge. And it would speed up almost all disk operations on the Commodore 64. It was a great piece of hardware, well, technically software, but in a hardware base. And it did its job very well. But it didn't work for everything. And it tied up your cartridge port, right? So if you wanted to do something else with your cartridge port, you couldn't have Fast Load in there. Action Replay combined fast loading, a DOS shell, which, by the way, DOS commands on the Commodore 64 sucked, right? Anybody who remembers that, you know what I'm talking about. It included a DOS shell, a fast loader, essentially the memory snapshotting of the Ice Pick. It allowed you to rip music out of games. It let you rip graphics out of games. The Action Replay cartridge, it wasn't just about entering cheat codes like it turned into later on for consoles. The Action Replay was the frickin' bee's knees when it came to utility cartridges. There's almost nothing that thing didn't do. And it was pricey. It was like $60. But believe me, it did everything. And it had a button on, it had two buttons. It also added a hardware reset. A lot of Commodore 64s, if you go looking at people's personal Commodore 64s, not stock footage, not stock photos. But if you go and you look at on Google and you look for, you know, my Commodore 64 and you go to images, you'll see Commodore 64s that have these little switches and buttons on the top of them. And a lot of that were put in by the owners, right? They didn't come as part of the thing. There were little switches and momentary buttons that were put in by the owners to avoid having to shut the machine off. It was a hard reset. It grounded something. I don't remember what the ground was. But it would let you do a almost power off of the Commodore 64 without actually flipping the switch. Because that switch wore out. You turn the Commodore 64 on and off like 17 times a day. Eventually that switch is going to wear out. That's why, Mr. Funny Man Chris, that's why I've got something like my Power Commander unit. Because I had to turn Commodore 64s on and off 700 times a day. So instead of using a hardware switch on the side of the computer, I put it into this command center where I could flip the just the computer on and off, Mr. Smart Man. Anyway, so the Action Replay cartridge featured a hard reset in addition to the freeze button. So it was like the jack of all trades. To own a Commodore 64 without an Action Replay cartridge is almost criminal. Because, I mean, just forget the piracy part of it. Forget the fact that you can steal software with it. But the ability to go in and have a machine language monitor where you could go in and give yourself infinite lives by searching for changes, delta changes in the code, right? So let's say you had five lives, right? You're playing the game, blah, blah, blah. You hit the freeze button on the cartridge. It says, how many lives do you have now? Well, I have five. Okay, good. Now, I'm going to put you back in the game, and as soon as you lose a life, hit the button again. So, you go, it dumps you back into the game, you play, you lose a life, as soon as you see your number decrement from 5 to 4, you push the button again. Boom, it picks up and says, okay, let me see if I can find a change in memory for you. So it digs through memory until it tries to find one that makes sense, that matches that decrement. It's like, oh, I think I found it. Would you like me to attempt to give you infinite lives on that value? And like, 80% of the time the thing worked, man. It was crazy. It was so crazy what you could do with that cartridge. It was by far the greatest thing, and I'd never seen anything like it. They tried to make one for the Amiga, but I don't think I ever got my hands on it. Then they made Action Replay for consoles, which was basically cheats, right? Alter the memory while, during the game's play so you can give yourself infinite lives or infinite health or whatever. But it was nothing at all like what Action Replay started off as. Well, I hope you enjoyed. This is the longest editorial commentary I've ever made. Celebrating 30 years of unbelievable gaming, the computers and the hardware that gave it to us. I hope you enjoyed this. Stick around. We've got David Thiel's interview. We've got a huge Bits and Bytes. We got reviews of Dragon's Lair coming up for the Android. Stick around. It's going to be a fantastic show. This month is part two of the David Thiel interview. David Thiel is a classic game sound engineer, and he's still working today, working on Stern Pinball sounds. And this guy is more than just a sound artist. He's an interactive engineer. He's got fantastic stories working with computers, consoles, arcade cabinets, pinball machines. This guy's touched and worked with it all. Fantastic interview. This is part two. If you missed part one last month, you might want to go check it out because we're going to jump right back into the interview already in progress. And that's very easy to prove. We have a local place called Castles and Coasters. It's like the last bastion of arcade here. Mm-hmm. And they literally have probably 40 pins, wow, which is insane. And they've got them all, like from the earlier ones. I mean, they don't have Hercules or anything, but I mean, they've got ones that are, you know, fairly, I'm not electromechanical, but maybe one generation above that. But a lot of them are set for very, very quiet or no sound at all.
Right.
And it is a very debilitating experience to play pinball with no sound.
And not as much fun.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's almost work then, which is weird.
Yeah.
You know, you're being entertained.
Yeah. No, the audio channel is crazy important. So from a sound guy's perspective, both the scale of the projects and the task and the importance of the task is very rewarding. And I've thought with trepidation about, you know, taking some console game jobs. Because, I mean, everything is different, right? I mean, I probably wouldn't enter in as senior designer, though I probably should.
I don't know if you'd, based on what I know of you, I don't think you would enjoy that work very much, it doesn't sound like.
Well, it depends. I mean, if I'm given godlike powers to move things forward, I certainly could do it and would enjoy it. But the reality being what it is, I doubt that would happen. So, yeah, you're right. There could be some frustration.
What about, now I'm sure you've explored all of this, but just off the top of my head, to me, these days, the last bastion of classic style gaming has moved to mobile devices or portable devices. And that seems like an area which I would think that you would be very interested in.
Yeah, I haven't, you know, I've been kept so busy with my pinball work that I just haven't explored anything else, to be frank.
Now, can you make a living? I mean, can you make a decent living? I mean, there's what, one pinball game a year that comes out? I mean, you have to augment your income with something else other than just the once a year pinball, right?
Shane, let me inform you.
Oh, here we go. I'm in the wrong line of work, I think.
I'm working right now on pinball number 4 for 2011.
Really?
Yes. I started the year with Rolling Stone.
Okay.
Second one was Tron. Third one was Transformers, which is just about finished and is out.
You can't tell me about the fourth
one. And I can't tell you about the fourth one.
Can you tell me?
The Steve Ritchie game.
Okay, I wasn't sure if I could say that or not. So.
Oh, sure. Yeah, everybody knows. I mean, in the pinball community. And in fact, I've even seen Steve mention the project on Facebook. So,
oh.
But I'm not, you know, that's him. I'm a contractor. I don't want to muddy the water. So, no, I'm not going to say what it is, though I think everybody knows.
But I'm assuming it is, and see, I don't know. I'm going to have to go freaking Google it. But I'm assuming that it is a high-profile, licensed scenario.
Well, they all are. I haven't,
right.
You know, this is pinball number 13, and every one of them spent a high-profile license.
Good point. Okay.
So, there's, you know, this is an outlier, though. This year, you know, you're right. But I have done, on average, 2.5 games since 2006. For the last 5 years.
Wow. For some reason, I was thinking that it was a little bit slower going up. But Stern's like still the only pinball machine maker out there at this point, right?
Well, technically, they're the only ones currently producing. There's a new company that is working on a Wizard of Oz pinball.
Really?
Yeah, Jersey Jack. Just use Jersey Jack as a search term. And they have some of the Williams designers.
Interesting.
And they've been working on this now for, you know, well over a year. So it's going to be spectacular. And it's going to be, it's very expensive. I mean, it's like $7,500.
Oh, my God. That's crazy.
Well, there's cheaper deals, right? If you're willing, see, they're starting a company, right? So people could put some money down,
sure,
and get a deal and this and that. But that, basically, that's what it's going to be. But it's going to be full of toys, and it's a wide body, which people haven't done in a while. And the people involved are top notch, and have had a long time to work on it. So, you know,
sure,
everybody's very excited about that.
And then, what about you guys? What does Stern think about that? You can't speak for Stern, I understand, but
yeah, I can. You know, actually, I mean, from my point of view, I think it's really good. You know, it may not be functionally good, but in some ways, it certainly pushes things forward for the player.
Sure, sure.
Because
I mean,
they're competing now. I mean, they know.
Yes.
Stern knows what's going on, and. There are things about the last few games that are just a little bigger, a little more expensive, because Jersey Jack's pushing the envelope, that Stern is pushing the envelope, I think, more than they would have.
Well, competition's good, you know. And even from a nice, friendly, competitive developer point of view, right? I mean, that's going to push Stern to give you guys a little more cash, maybe give you guys a little more liberty to try some new stuff.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see how this works out. I love the pinball work, and I like pinball. I'm not much of a player, but I always have one around now. And for 5 years, the machines come and go.
Right. You can't get attached to any of them, I bet.
Well, you wouldn't, because they're mostly whitewoods. They're all undecorated slabs of maple with parts on them.
Gotcha. So you get not even prototypes, I would imagine. You get whatever comes
prototype, but typically the way it works is I get the cast off of the original prototype, and then when they get a nicer one or a painted one, and the programmer gets that, then I get his cast offs.
So do you think the Ritchie project is – maybe you know this for a fact, or maybe you can't say. Do you think that the Ritchie project is a direct result of that Jersey Jack startup?
Certainly there are aspects of it, I think, that gave him the license to really pump it up. I mean, it's pretty spectacular. I mean, I know what it is, and I've seen it. And it's going to be spectacular. And I don't know if they would have gone there. But see, the market is changing. The whole business model for pinball has changed. Pinball used to be like movies, right?
Yeah.
Movies come out to theaters, And then 8 months later, they make VHS tapes and sell them to the home.
Right.
So pinballs used to be bought by operators, an operator for 8 months. And then when earnings dropped off, that used machine would be sold to a collector. And that's how it was forever. But little by little, over the last 10 years, maybe it started even before Williams went out of the business, that percentage has changed, and collectors now buy new in box more frequently.
Right.
So that changes the market a lot. And then, you know, in the middle of that, we have this amazing economic kerfuffle. So the discretionary money to buy new in-box pinball machines certainly is less available than it was, let's say, 6 years ago.
Sure. And I haven't actually priced a brand new pinball in a while. What does, say, a Transformers pinball go for?
I don't know. You know, it's a complicated story because now they make three or four different models of it.
There's
a pro model, which is really what operators would operate. And then they make a limited edition, which is literally limited. They only make 250 or 400 of them. And then with Transformers, then they made a Decepticon Transformer model, which is a limited edition that's painted all Decepticon colors.
Right.
And they made an Autobot model. And they did a limited edition of each of those.
Wow.
So and the prices for limited editions are obviously more. I mean, this is obviously for a collector, right? Who cares that there's a plaque on it that says this is 260 or 400?
Right.
They started this limited edition thing about 5 games ago. Well, they actually did it even longer. There was a limited edition, I think, Elvis game, which was before I even started in 2004 or 5. So they've toyed with this model, but they're really committed to it now. So collector who wants something, who feel confident that the thing will not drop in value, in fact will raise in value because it's limited.
Right.
And then the pros, Europe was always, people don't realize that Europe has been for 30 years the most consistent market for American pinball machines.
Really? Okay. I did not know that.
Well, when I started at Gottlieb back in the day, that was a very dark time for pinball, no matter what company, Bally, Williams, Gottlieb, because of Space Invaders and Pac-Man. American operators just hardly bought any pinballs at all, relatively.
That's bizarre.
And there were at least 5 years, maybe 8 years, that was true. And so, of course, all the companies got into video.
And good point. And then
pinball companies, in the face of that, tried to innovate their way out. So you get Haunted House, and you get these games with play fields underneath play fields with Fresnel lenses, or Caveman with a, video screen mounted inside the pinball play field.
Right.
Or games, Hyperball, and all these, they just went wild with innovation trying to recapture market share. And that really didn't work. But eventually, in the late 80s and early 90s, when they finally figured out, we've had this microprocessor in these games for a long time, but we really haven't been exploiting what we could do with it. Originally, it was just a replacement for all those relays and score reels and stuff.
Sure.
But you have the wave of games. Really, Larry DeMar is the man. He's the man, the co-man behind Defender, and he's also teamed up with some very talented pin designers, the man who helps exploit the power of having a processor in a pinball machine. And so pinball, starting in the late 80s and going through to the mid-90s, gets huge. And you get games that sell 20,000 units, 30,000 units. It was huge, but they figured out how to make them more entertaining, more better toys, and much more programming. They get the dot display, so they can put graphics up there, and they get much better sound, and so on.
What's your favorite era of pinball?
You know, I'm real happy with where it is now, frankly. I have a 17-year gap, okay? When I was at IT, our company, as contract work, created the operating system for the Data East pinball machines. I got to design the soundboard. I created the sound software and sounds for like five games in that time. And I liked that. That was a lot of fun. And then I stopped, our company stopped doing that. And then I kind of turned my attention elsewhere. And so I have this 17-year gap between that and then when I resumed in 2006. So I missed really the golden age of pinball, the Pat Lawler games, the Steve Ritchie games, Twilight Zone and all that stuff. But I have, you know, it was due diligence for me to go back and do the research and figure out what happened while I was gone. And I played those games, and I like those games. And I understand why people like those games. But my own preference, I'm a shooter. I really like to shoot pinball. And the modern games, the ones that they've been making recently, I like those a lot. The older games with lots and lots of toys and lots of crazy ramps and stuff, Williams had this deal where they just loved to hide the ball. You'd shoot a thing, and the ball would disappear for a while, would roll underneath the play field or go somewhere else, and then pop out over here.
Right.
I was never a huge fan of that.
You like having the ball where you can see it.
Yeah, and the modern pins, you know, the play field, there's less stuff. You know, and part of that's economics, but it's also a matter of, it's a design philosophy. You know, you have seven or eight or nine things to do at the top of the play field mostly. And there are ramps, and there's toys, and there's mechanisms, and ejects, and there's all this stuff. And across the, from left to right, there are like seven or eight things to do. And they require shooting. They require accuracy, you know, to hit these things and do the different things. And plus, you go around the orbits. You get a real nice fast. You know, there's nothing as satisfying to me as hitting a spinner, setting that off, going around the top and coming out the other side, picking that ball at the right moment, and then doing it again or making another shot off that for a combo. I like that kind of stuff. I'm very bad at it, but I like it.
So just to kind of continue moving forward here, because I know we're running a little later than I had promised, and you let me know, too, if you need to leave at any particular time.
No,
I can literally listen to this forever.
You can cut this up as necessary. I'm good.
One of the things I found fascinating is I'm always interested in rights and IP and copyright and dealing with licensees and things like that. So I've talked to a lot of my interviews about that. Now, in your Data East work, I noticed on your presentation that a lot of the early work was all inspired, you know, Secret Service and Time Machine. Yeah. We're all inspired by some pop culture thing that was going on at the time, but you made it clear that there really wasn't a licensing thing going on at that point in time, but there was themes that went along with that. Was that financial in nature, that they didn't want to spend the money to buy, you know, Back to the Future or whatever?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It is a financial thing, but it's also, let's call it a dance. Nobody had invented the dance yet. And the dance is a way to go into a licensor and convince them that it's mutually beneficial for them and you, for them to give you rights to their intellectual property for next to nothing. Because of cross-marketing.
Okay. How does that work? I mean, give me an example. I mean, even if it's a fake one, you know, just how would that work?
Well, okay, so you have a franchise. Let's see. Let's pick a franchise that hasn't been done. So you have that Twilight Vampire franchise, right?
Oh, geez. Okay.
I don't like it, but
not
that's why I'm using it.
Perfect.
So you have all this stuff that's associated with it. You have characters, you have activities, you have faces and voice and the music that goes with Twilight. You have all this stuff. And you go in, you make a pitch in their office, and you say, well, you know, there's a whole bunch of interesting guys between 20 and 45 that you're not reaching.
Right.
And if you let us make a pinball game based on on Twilight and it gets out there, you have this thing that's so much better than a billboard or a sign or anything else, because it'll last for years.
Right.
People will play it, and then Twilight will be on their brain. And then they will go to Netflix or they will go somewhere, and they'll be interested in your thing even if they hadn't been before, because they're curious. I'm just getting, I've never done this, but I'm guessing that this is what they do, right? Because they can't, pinball just doesn't make that much money to be able to go in with, you know, $500,000, plop it down on the desk and say, give us the assets. That just doesn't happen.
Well, and I was kind of amazed to hear, I mean, just the whole ritual, just the piece of getting voice actors, right? I mean, in your presentation, you said that you have to let the original actor say no first. What's that about?
Well, there are contracts. There's a standard contract. And the contract's gotten more elaborate and weirder since the strike. Remember there was a strike?
Right, right. Like 4 years ago, something like that?
Yeah, a lot of that was about derivative products.
Okay.
Of which, of course, a pinball machine is. And so actors, rightfully so, they want a piece of that.
Sure.
So it's gotten even tougher. I mean, usually a studio, it used to be, let's say 3 years ago or 4 years ago, a studio could just say, okay, anything that's off the soundtrack of this movie, you can cut up and use. They don't say that anymore. Now they'll
really?
Say, well, you can use this actor and this actor and this actor because our contract with them included, we paid them money to include derivative products. But these people, we didn't pay that to them because we didn't see the need, so you can't use them.
Really?
Yeah.
So in the case, in the demo that you were talking about Pirates of the Caribbean and Johnny Depp, right?
Yeah.
So the studio, you made the negotiations to use the IP, and of course they have all this probably carte blanche decision making over it and all that other stuff. And then you got to the part where, you know, you're doing Captain Jack Sparrow. So you had to actually, somebody had to call Johnny Depp and say, do you want to do this?
Well, okay. Disney, somebody talked to his agent. Right.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And
not
they,
to him.
You know, they say, well, we have this gig you could do. And, you know, there isn't that much money. Do you want to do it? And he says no. Okay.
Right.
In the case of Disney, they're very protective of their property.
Yeah.
So they weren't going to let you hire somebody to sound like Johnny Depp.
Right.
But fortunately, because of all the, you know, that Disney's very good about exploiting their intellectual property, they already had a guy who sounded like Captain Jack. And, in fact, I think he sounds almost more like Captain Jack than Johnny Depp does.
If you That's can weird how that works. I can understand that.
I mean, he was great. He was really great. And so there was a recording session where it was done on the Disney property in a big studio. There was a Disney engineer, and there was a Disney producer, and then there was the voice talent.
That's
and
crazy.
He was the other end of the phone, and they directed the session from a pre-approved script.
Wow.
This guy would, you know, do 20 lines, and then he would ask the recording engineer to play another example from the movie so he could recharge his ear. It was very informative. That was my first game coming back, and I'm much more of a recording engineer and a director of audio sessions now than I was then.
Oh, I bet.
So I learned a lot from the Disney session, which was run very professionally. But keep in mind, they ran this session. If he said the phrase three times, they were the ones who picked which reading. I mean, they consulted me, but they say, we like the second one. Is that okay with you?
And
I was only
crazy.
And I was not going to get the raw session. All I got were the ones that they approved.
Wow, that seems so, I don't know, I guess the term I'm looking for is wasteful. I mean,
no, it's controlling. I mean, they're there to protect their IP.
That's crazy. I mean, it seems crazy to me. I mean, I guess it's just business as usual for you, but that would make me mental to have to do that.
Oh, no. What makes you mental? I don't know if I should even, I suppose, this is true. I don't think anybody will care. What made us crazy was that we wrote the script, we had a whole bunch of other characters in the game that were not in the movie, but but they were in our they were pirates in our pirate game, right?
Right.
And we wanted to talk, you know, the custom speech, the things that refers to game elements that obviously are not in the movie.
Sure.
Well, the rules came down that we couldn't have them. Well, was it Captain Jack? I guess we could have them talk about some pinball stuff. Captain Jack could not say anything that was anachronistic. He couldn't talk about a pinball or a multi-ball or any game element.
What was the purpose? I mean, did they explain why they couldn't do that?
No, they don't have to explain.
Well, no, of course not. But I mean,
but the reason why, I mean, they didn't want to degrade their character, you know, by having step out of character and talk about pinball.
But they do it on video games. I mean, there's video games where Captain Jack will say, press the X button.
But video games step up to the table with, you know.
A lot more cash. Okay. Yeah. it's back to money again. I got it.
Yeah. So, but in any case, so we built a script of maybe 400 phrases and sent it off to Disney to their licensing group, and they read it, and then it came back, you know, blue penciled with things that were changed and this and that or eliminated for some reason. Like, we couldn't say scallywag.
Well, okay.
You can't say scallywag. And there's a long reason, but you don't want to spend the time doing it.
I'd love to know, but maybe another time.
Yeah. Take this offline. Why you can't say scallywag.
That's so great.
So, great. So then we had these sessions. And in that time, we were also localizing these pinball games to five languages.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Session, we had a session in German, in Spanish, in Italian, in French,
in English. So do the pirates have to sound German, too, or do they have to sound like Captain Jack saying German words? You know, does that make sense?
Captain Jack was only in English. But there were five other pirates that spoke. When you're in a certain mode, Pirate A spoke. And there was we had different pirates. Like, one was an effete gentleman pirate. And then we had a girl pirate. And then we had a kind of Bluebeard type pirate. And so on. And so, yeah, it was real interesting to record the German or the French version. Oh, we had a French pirate. So then we had to have a French reader read the French pirate. But how does he make fun? I mean, you know, he's kind of like Inspector Clouseau. You know, how do the French feel about Inspector Clouseau? I guess that's the question, right? It was weird.
That's funny. That is bizarre.
Okay, so we had these enormous long recording sessions. So let's call it 5 times 400. So we've recorded 2,000 phrases. God. In the meantime, the script had wandered over to Disney Creative.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, the writers. And they're writers. And they look at what we've written. They don't like it.
It's a pinball machine, you guys. Come
so
on.
They improved it. And they sent it back to us with the improvements. And basically what it was, you know, you either record our improvements or you don't get these lines.
Ugh.
So basically, a third of the lines ended up on the floor because we just didn't have the resources or the time or anything else to go back and have five more recording sessions in five languages. That wasn't going to happen. So that's your worst case. Now, to balance this out, I do want to say that was that Disney. And then when we did Tron, it was like day and night. I had
really
It was glorious. I had access to more assets from the movie, and I had they sent me gigabytes of raw material that was used to create the sound effects for Tron. Not the sound effects, but the raw material created by their sound effects designers. I mean, I just had so much stuff. It was Disney was great, and I came away from the first one kind of shell-shocked.
Right.
Boy, if all licensors are like this, this is going to be hard. But then, you know, it's a different company now. Oh, let's see. Okay, turn that off. The whole license, I call it the rules of engagement.
That's probably the best phrase to explain it.
And each facet has its own set of rules. And if you see my talk, I break it all down in that, right? Quite complicated, but
it is.
You know, within each domain, we got a new project. Are we going to get music? If we get music, are we going to, you know, get the soundtrack actually, like we did on Indiana Jones, we actually had John Williams waving his stick at the London Symphony Orchestra. We had the Indiana Jones March, and that plays behind main play. You know, that's it, right? It's fabulous. Of course, then I had to sound like John Williams and the London Symphony Orchestra for all other modes.
That whole segment of your presentation fascinated me. The fact that, I mean, because you don't, you, no one thinks about this stuff. I mean, it's like the stunt guy. You never think about the stunt guy.
Yeah.
And that's really who you are. I mean, you're, and I am not butt kissing at all. Your work sounded, it didn't, it sounded exactly the same to me. I mean, you, you could have put the march up and then played your, market chase at the end. And I would have thought it came from the same place.
Well, thank you. That's the highest praise I can get for that, because it's a hard thing to do. I learned a lot about orchestration. I'm not that kind of musician, and I am more like that kind of musician now. That's the other thing about the pinball stuff, is the incredible diversity across licenses.
So what is, I mean, what kind of insane pressure, just because my a lot of my listeners probably haven't seen your presentation, which after you're done listening to this show, of course, you can go listen to the presentation, but finish this first. You the only thing that you guys actually got from an audio perspective point of view was that march, that main, you know, recognizable, yeah, worth every penny, as you said.
Oh, yeah.
March, and then you had, of course, that's not the only piece of music in the game. You had to go and match that type of music and that sound with all the other pieces of music in the game.
I had to think, I had to be able to write like John Williams and write. See, we featured all four movies in that pinball.
Right, I remember.
So, Temple of Doom took place in Asia. It had an Indian thing going on. And you can see what John Williams did with that, you know, how he took his materials and made them sound appropriate for an Oriental Asian game. Then the third movie has a strong component. It takes place in pre-war Germany. So we have a lot of Nazis marching around.
Right.
And our main villain is Nazi. So you see what John Williams did there.
So what did you do with it when the game went to Germany?
Oh, you know, you gotta love it. You know, there's going to be a tuba in there somewhere,
right?
So, I mean, I learned, I bought. You can buy the score. I had the orchestral score from the John Williams March,
right?
And many things that I didn't know about orchestration, the techniques of making an orchestra sound that way, by listening and reading the score, oh my God, so that's how you do one of those runs with the piccolo to make it sound exciting like that.
The piccolo.
Well, and initially, we didn't know whether we were going to get the recording or what's called performance rights. Where
now, go into that just a little bit. I think my listeners would love to understand, because you could actually buy the official song and play it, right? I mean,
right.
What do they call
a
that?
Recording. Well, recording. That's. I think it's mechanical rights. Basically, you have the rights to take a recording and digitize it and stick it in the game.
As is.
And so in Tron, for instance, we licensed four tracks from the soundtrack album. And then I cut that up, and it ends up being maybe six or seven modes in the game. And then for the remaining seven pieces of music, I wrote Daft Punk music.
Right.
I call it D-Punk. Okay, so that's a type of right, and that's obvious. It's typically more expensive. The other thing is, let's say, like a Family Guy. We could not use any of the music from the show. We couldn't take it from the show, digitize it, and put it in the game. We could not do that. But we bought the rights to the tune, the Family Guy theme.
Right.
Okay. And that's like buying a piece of sheet music, which has da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da, that thing.
Yeah.
Now, then I performed it. And in fact, in Family Guy, I performed it five different ways. There's a heroic version. There's a version which is Zydeco. Which is kind of like a perverse polka. There's one that sounds like it is in the show, which is a studio orchestra like from the Dick Van Dyke Show. That's the model on which Family Guy music is based, is that 1960s sitcom when they still used those sort of big orchestras. They're not quite an orchestra.
Right.
They're like a dance band augmented with strings kind of thing.
Right.
And so I did one of those, and I used it like two other ways. So I had that theme, those chords, those notes, that's what I had a right to use, and then I performed it I orchestrated it and arranged it and performed it in many different ways. And that's a different right. Typically, that's less expensive.
So the rights to the original tune, right? But you took it and altered it. Doesn't that kind of change the boundaries of the license or anything like that?
Well, we had the license for me to re-perform the tune, digitize it, and stick it in the game.
Right, right.
Subject
okay.
to approval.
Of course.
Right. So it had to go back to the licensor, and they go, okay, well, you didn't mutilate this too much. You can do this.
You think it'd be cheaper and easier for them to just say, here, we'll give you the cut and dry, and you can just use it. I guess I don't understand why it's more expensive to do that than to have you go through this whole approval process and back and forth, and you got to go get your own musicians.
Well, it's a matter of what they own about the music.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
When I work for a coin-op company, or when I work for video game companies, typically the deal is they pay you money and it's work for hire, and everything that you produce they own.
Right.
And for movies and for television, that isn't true necessarily.
Mm.
The guy who wrote the Family Guy theme retains ownership of the Family Guy theme. And when they recorded it on Fox's Nickel, that orchestra and stuff, those recordings, they probably have a license deal where Fox can use those into perpetuity for the cartoon show.
Right.
But they didn't secure, it wasn't work for hire. Fox doesn't own those performances. They just have a license to use them for the cartoon shows.
Ah, okay.
So the person who produced those things could take them, put them on a CD, and sell them, right, independent of Fox. Maybe Fox gets a taste, but they own them for other purposes.
Interesting. Wow, how convoluted is it?
That's it's very
amazing.
Anything that can be written in a contract, instrument, you get lawyers involved and you have all these rights, and the minute you start licensing things, I mean, I heard your thing about the cloud and whether you don't ever own a video game, even if you have the disc. All you've purchased is a limited license to use it for yourself. Theoretically, right. You can't sell it or rent it or do anything with it. You can just play it on your console until your console breaks. So it's the same kind of deal for music. And it gets way complicated because, musical rights have existed since there have been recordings. So for 100 years, there's been some form of musical rights. Then you add radio to that and you start broadcasting it for free. Well, maybe not. Maybe an organization like ASCAP or BMI comes in and tries to get the people who are broadcasting it to take some of the money they're getting from commercials and get that. Somehow get it back to the artist, probably.
Wow. You know, it's amazing that anything actually gets done at the end of the day.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's not unlike software patents, right?
Right.
Software patents make it very, very difficult to write anything new because somewhere somebody's got a patent on a technique that you used that, you would never think that could be possibly protected.
Right.
And look how Apple's gone after...
What a nightmare. I mean, I understand, and that's a discussion for a whole other show, I guess.
Well, yeah, and copyright law in America has become increasingly crazy and draconian, and this is in part because of Mickey Mouse.
Maybe I missed something specific about Mickey Mouse.
Well, okay, Mickey Mouse, given the way the copyright laws were, this was, 10 years ago, 15 years ago,
right.
The way the copyright law was, Disney was going to lose control. He was going to slip into the public domain because the amount of time you could protect a thing was running
75 years or something, right?
Whatever it was.
Yeah.
So Disney and maybe other copyright holders petitioned Congress, and they rewrote the copyright law. So that extended the amount of time that.
Okay. I didn't know Disney was behind that, but okay, I understand what, I remember that incident.
Yeah. So now, you know, copyright holders have, it tends to squelch certain kinds of expression because they can own their things forever. And that was never what was the intention with copyright law, like patent law. It's meant to provide a financial motivation to the people who create IP, intellectual property, but also to, you know, allow things to combine and make new stuff without draconian licensing things. Okay. But all these issues are... all these issues are germane, right, to the question of, you know, when you deal with licensors, and the only thing I can ever say when people ask me this question, you know, what's it like? I say, well, it's different every time. The rules of engagement, I've tried to train my client now to, I mean, I need to know this as soon as possible.
Well, yeah. I mean, it could totally change what you have to do.
Right. So for Tron, I had to write 6 or 7 songs. Obviously, for the Rolling Stone game, I wrote 1, you know, but it was all Rolling Stones music.
Right.
Transformers, I wrote every piece of music. And
wow.
More interestingly, because of the design, this sort of bimodal thing where we have, you're either a Decepticon or you're an Autobot, there are almost 50% more game modes in this pinball game.
Wow.
When you play as a Decepticon, there are Autobot game modes you will never see.
Right.
And vice versa.
Wow.
So every aspect of dressing up a game mode, right? Communicating that you're in this game mode. And obviously in the Transformers, it's all based on, I am Ironside. I am Starscream. I am, you know, whichever Autobot character or Decepticon character. They each have their own music. They each have their own, fanfares and stingers for rewards when you, you know, score jackpots and do good things. This game, besides being completely original, I had to create 50% more assets for it.
Wow. Well, I mean, it's got to at least be interesting. I mean, if you were just kind of recutting up the same stuff and doing it over and over again, I could see that being less than
desirable
result.
I have always resisted that. It's just me. I mean, there was some pressure when I was at Gottlieb, you know, to create a library of sounds and just keep reusing them. And
oh, yeah.
I never did that.
Well, you can tell. Krull's got some of the most, I mean, I'm a huge Krull fan, okay?
Oh, good.
I'm like one of the last, I think I'm the only person on the planet that loves it. I actually have the marquee from the arcade game in my cube at work. I'll have to send you a picture just because it's like, what's Krull? I mean, everybody walks by, what's Krull?
Let me tell you. At not this last arcade Northwest game show, but at the previous one, prior to that show in June, I owned a reactor.
Right.
In my shop, I had a reactor, and it was collecting dust, and it was over in the corner. I just wasn't doing anything with it. So I finally decided to sell it to a collector who was very happy to have it. I was happy to get the floor space back because, I mean, I can play it on MAME if I want to.
Sure.
So then when I went to that show in June... Okay. It's not for me. When I went to that show in June, there were, in the video game portion of this show, there were the first 4 Gottlieb games that I had worked on in order.
Whoa.
So starting, there was a reactor, and then there was a Q-Bert, and then there was a Mad Planets, and then there was a Krull. It was the coolest thing ever because I, you know, it's been years since I've seen some of these, and I hadn't played Krull probably since I left Gottlieb. And I left Gottlieb in like 83. So I got a chance to play them all again.
That's so cool. Collectors are weird like that. You know, one of my friends here locally, Brian King, he's a huge arcade collector, and he's a Williams nut.
Yeah.
And he's just, I think that's how he's got them. I think he's got them all in his little arcade in, you know, order by year, alphabetical order, or something crazy like that. And it's amazing. But Kroll, you know, okay, first of all, let's be honest. Was the movie great? Eh, maybe not.
That was first licensed project.
Was it really?
Yeah, see, understand.
And I bet that was nothing.
understand that Gottlieb was owned by Columbia Pictures.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
That must have been a lot easier.
Well, you know, the degree to which you could adapt movie assets to a video game, you know, with the horsepower of the Gottlieb system.
Right.
You know, the guys that did it did a fantastic job.
I completely agree.
Matt Householder and Chris Krubel. Very, very talented guys. That was the only project I worked on there where there were two programmers who basically shared things.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I thought that was a very interesting game in terms of the sound, of course. Like I said, for me, a lot of people don't buy sound as being a huge portion. I mean, obviously you do, and a few of us do appreciate that level of commitment with interactive audio engineering. I have a whole new catchphrase in my vocabulary now. Your title. Kroll just immediately just pulled me in with the sound and the audio and the transition audio, and everything in there was just way too cool.
Well, I can't tell you how many days I spent. It was several days that I spent trying to come up with the algorithm, the program that when it moved the speaker made it sound like the foot sloshing around in a swamp.
It's a shame you don't have like recordings or something of this stuff, because I'd love to see what didn't make it into the game. You know what I mean?
Oh, you're right. You know, it's when you're creating a lot with nothing, and right. Really, you know, that 6502 wasn't even running at 1 megahertz. It was running at like 896,000, you know.
Right.
Because it was cheaper to put a color burst crystal, like from a TV set, onto the board and divide that down to something lower than 1 megahertz. So it was the worst case in some ways. I mean, I like the processor, but that was very, very hard. So you couldn't use any traditional methods of synthesis because the algorithms that ran them all ran way too slow. So you had to think about it very differently. And so you wrote – basically what I did is I just wrote a lot of algorithms, and – 3/4 of them ended on the ground. They never got used because I would discover something, right? I'm going over here. My goal is over here. And I discover something. Oh, I can use that in this other game. You know, it was not as deterministic. There's a whole lot of serendipity.
Yeah.
And that actually refers to something. The guy who ran the game division was a really interesting guy named Ron Waxman. He was a huge guy, and he used to just sit in his office. But he was very wise, right? And Ron said, you know, nobody knows what's fun. Nobody knows how to make these games, really. Almost nobody knows. This is very early on, right? And he's right. And so video game design is really a random walk. So the key from a management standpoint is to have as many people walking as randomly as possible.
Right.
And that's the way game dev was done at Gottlieb. They had a guy, well, I mentioned him, Jim Weiss, who designed the soundboard. He went on to design the dev station. So because our processor was the same thing as in the PC.
Yeah.
It was an 8088.
Right.
He built a board system. He built an adapter board, which extended the processor inside the PC out into the Gottlieb game system. So the Gottlieb game system looked like a peripheral to the PCs. This allowed you to use the PC as its dev station.
Wow.
Which takes you down from, you know, about $20,000 per developer to, at that time, about $2,500 per developer.
Wow.
So it enabled us to have a lot more people walking more randomly.
Sure.
And that's Jim Weiss's determination and genius to have figured that out. So all the game, you know, after the first like I'm trying to think if Qbert was developed on the Blue Box or the PC. I'm not sure. Probably it was kind of halfway. But, I mean, the PC was a much better environment, development environment, than the Intel Blue Box anyhow.
Right.
I mean, we had hard disks by that time. You know, a 5 meg hard disk. That's heaven. That's heaven.
I bet.
First time I got a 10 meg hard drive, I was like quivering with excitement. That was wonderful.
Yeah, my first Amiga drive was 20 megs, I think, and that was like being let out of prison. So.
Absolutely. Oh, you'll always remember, as a technical guy, you'll always remember your first hard drive.
It's totally true. Or your second disk drive, the day you got your second drive, especially if you had an Amiga, because, that was some time.
That was true with an Apple, too. When they're so small, they're like 130K, right?
Yeah.
you can't even do a disk copy. I mean, you can't even do a backup.
No. There's not enough memory. You have to do it in pieces or something.
It's tough to be old. But, well, in my second talk, which is not available, I did a little thing which I compared and contrasted the enterprise of working on these things with the devastation I had at Gottlieb versus the devastation I have now.
Right.
And when you run the numbers, it's like insane.
I bet.
Because the Apple II in today's dollars is about a $10,000 thing.
Right.
And my computer, which I built, if it's $1,200, I'd be very surprised.
Right.
And it's got 8 gig of memory. And my Apple II
has
48K. And you do the comparison. And the reason this is interesting is, for people to understand that if you work in this field, imagine if you worked on cars. In 1980, you had a car which did what it did. And now you work on cars, and it's been on the same Moore's Law improvement curve as solid-state technology.
Sure.
You'd be working on a car that would get like 250,000 miles to the gallon.
Right.
Would be traveling near light speed. Would be free,
Right.
And so anybody who works in this field has one of the things, they have to be very robust in the face of just relenting improvement.
Yeah.
In ways that change everything about the business models and what you've learned. You know, the fact that I can program the 6502 like nobody's business, that and a nickel would not even get me in the door at Starbucks.
Right. Yeah, it's amazing. And those early guys, you know, the early 80s with Activision and Atari, these guys were rock stars. And, you know, you think about it, I kind of get it now in this day and age, knowing what I know and been through everything I've been through. These guys actually earned rock star status to me.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, these guys were like the guy that built that dev board, Jim, what was his last name?
Jim Weiss.
Weiss, come on! Nobody does that sort of thing anymore,
right?
You know,
it's pretty amazing what the really good people did. And then, okay, you had it in your notes. You wanted to, you know, what was it like to work on the Atom?
Yeah, I totally forgot my Atom question. It's not on this tickler list that I have. It's on a different one.
Well, I'm laughing, right? I mean, because here's a deal, right? Where you invest a lot on coming up on a new piece of technology.
Sure.
The Atom was more like the ColecoVision than not, but clearly it was much more than that.
Right.
And this is another case where their storage decision, you know, just completely sunk them.
Well, it's tape, right?
It was intelligent tape.
Damn.
So you put a tape in, and then they had a tape recorder that was under computer control that attempted to random, well, what? You know, how random can tape be?
Right. But so they you're saying, and I never owned an Atom. I actually had one for a brief time. I had it for a raffle, something I was doing with regards to the show. I gave it away. And so I never actually got to use one. So you're saying that the tape drive they used in a random access manner?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, not very, you know, okay, for the patient. Keep in mind, the device was amazingly cheap for what it was.
I can't remember.
It had a daisy wheel typewriter. part of
it. Didn't that also double as the power adapter? And that was like the worst design move they ever made was the fact that the printer went out, the whole system went down?
Boy, it's really hard to rank the bad decisions, Adam. I wouldn't even try. But functionally, you know, there's a Z80 in there, and there's the ColecoVision, you know, graphics pipeline, and a daisy wheel typewriter, which is pretty slick.
That was slick at the time, even if it was like 25 characters per second, whatever.
Yeah, slow, but I mean, it
looked good.
Better than the dot matrix of its time.
Sure.
And it had, you know, this random access storage thing. So it's just like, just think it's a really slow disk drive, but you get all of that for what was quite inexpensive at its time.
You know, with how big the box was, they might have just saved time by just packaging it in a coffin for you to take home.
Oh.
Wouldn't that have been, that would have been the
based
where that went.
So we were hired by them, by Coleco, to create some titles for the launch. And so we created what would have been, you know, several years later, these would have been the first wave of CD-ROM titles.
Really?
Well, because we had big storage, relatively speaking. The tape storage, while slow and stupid, was big.
Yeah.
Big like CD-ROM big. Bigger. I think it was bigger than it was certainly bigger than an Apple II disk drive.
Wow.
Well, it's tape, you know. It's,
oh, yeah.
So it was, relatively speaking, big and cumbersome. And if you took into account its serial nature, you know, for a game, you could live with it.
Right.
So we did three projects on it. They had the Jeopardy license, so we did a Jeopardy quiz game on Adam. We did a Family Feud on it. And these were the first time those TV shows had ever been done. And they were then ported to systems that survived.
Right.
But we, our company, did the first versions of those. And then the most amazing product, which, you know, is Richard Scarry's best electronic word book ever.
I've read that in my research of your plights and that just how that sucks.
Are you familiar? Do you have kids or you ever seen these books?
I have kids. I know the Richard Scarry line, but I don't know anything about this particular product.
Well, you wouldn't. It only ran on the Coleco Atom.
Oh, that's why.
You would never have seen it. But it was, you know, it was a Richard Scarry thing, featured Lowly Worm. He was your hero, driving around in his Apple car. And it was like a CD-ROM multimedia product. You drove around, and you'd get to a place, and you had to spell some word or do something. And then you'd get this big animation thing, and then you'd drive along until you'd solved all the words. Because it was basically an educational product. And then there'd be this 90-second load time, and then you'd get another world. What does this sound like? Sound like any console game, first-person thing that you ever heard of?
It pretty much does.
Yeah. And so we were really breaking new grounds with Richard Scarry's best electronic word book ever. And there were a ton of animations and a ton of sound to go with the animations. It's a big project. So, for history, the guy who was the lead programmer on this is Lonnie Ropp. Now, that may not be meaningful, but Lonnie Ropp has been at Stern since, I think, their third pinball game. He's been there ever since then. Nobody has programmed or been involved in the production of more modern pinball machines than Lonnie Ropp.
Interesting. That doesn't seem like a logical crossover.
Well, I mean, so Lonnie was one of our employees at IT. And so when we stopped doing pinball for Data East, and we'd had a layoff, Lonnie went over to Data East, and he's been there ever since. He's in charge over there now. And if that's in fact because I know Lonnie, that's how I got this gig.
Makes sense.
Yeah,
so, it's all about who you know.
It is all about who you know, pretty much in any field, but particularly a field as small and interesting as creating interaction.
Incredible. So let me get the list of things you've developed on. So you had the Atom, Commodore 64. You did some Amiga stuff, right? You said you did the Winter Games translation for that.
Well, I programmed the Winter Games translation, but then I did the sounds for Three Stooges.
Oh, thank you for bringing that up. That was one thing I wanted to make sure I touched on too. And you did the Amiga version of that, right?
Yes.
And so you worked with CinemaWare directly. What was it like working with those guys? Those guys seemed like they really had everything going over there.
Well, they did. They did. They were working on, I think they had already had, what is their Robin Hood title?
Defender of the Crown.
Defender of the Crown was out when we were working on Three Stooges. They're interesting guys, and you can search the web and find out lots of stories that I wouldn't repeat in a podcast.
Right.
So just the fact that you know that's true would allow
I can
you
find
a lot of amusement.
All right. I won't pry you for details.
But the deal with the product was that we had that, you know, they secured a good license and the cooperation of the people who owned the Three Stooges assets. And so they dumped on us a whole lot of VHS tapes of Three Stooges episodes.
Mm.
And so this is like my first time ever to have a platform that was sampling based so I could actually use the assets directly.
Nice.
So every day I did what I refer to as going down into the Stooge mines.
The Stooge mines?
Where I would mine for audio clips that I could use. Now, the good news about that is that those shorts were produced so cheaply
right.
that they had virtually no background music. They had the Three Blind Mice stuff at the front.
Right.
And then they had the some kind of vaudeville routine with the Three Stooges doing some kind of thing. And then they were out. And they almost never had any background music. So voice clips were reasonably uncluttered by that.
I was gonna say, that'd be a sampler's dream right there.
Well, that's the good news. The bad news, well, there's several forms of bad news here. One is that the Stooges were wonderful vaudevillians, and they had honed their craft in vaudeville. Their timing, their comedic timing, was like second to none. They were brilliant.
Right.
Well, their lines overlapped half the time. They were speaking so fast and doing all this stuff, finding a line in isolation that you could actually cut out. You had to go deep, deep into the Stooge mines to find those. Trust me.
Oh, I believe you completely.
And then part two of that is that it was all live sound, meaning that they just had some guy with a boom mic slightly out of frame
right.
capturing all this stuff. So, you know, they sound... From inside one episode, one 15-minute episode, the samples that you picked sound like they came from six different places.
Wow.
And it was really challenging to find a body of stuff that I could actually pull and then, you know, somehow relate it to the gameplay.
That must have been like, I mean, how much post could you do back then? I mean, it's not like you had, like, you know, SoundForge or anything back then, right?
Actually, I did.
Really?
Yeah, I think I did have SoundForge at that time. It was
really,
yeah, it was like, you know, SoundForge 1.
Wow,
I think that was my tool of choice. See, I was always a PC guy. I was
right.
swimming against the current because early on the Mac was the media creation tool of choice.
Right,
and I developed. Do you remember there was a company had VideoWorks and SoundWorks?
Yeah.
The two eventually turned into Macromind.
Okay.
Well, I developed the sound package for VideoWorks.
That's awesome.
I had a Lisa at my house because you couldn't do development for the Mac on the Mac.
Right.
You had to have a Lisa to do development for the Mac. So I had this is when I was independent and working out of my bedroom. I had a Lisa in there. It was a monster.
I bet.
And I basically took the Gottlieb work and ported it.
Huh.
So it did that same because again a Mac had no space. It was really kind of like a video game.
Right.
And so if you were trying to do animation stuff, you didn't have any space to hold sampled audio. So I've created a sound package of stuff that could be used as a library for VideoWorks.
Nice.
That's a little known fact. But
you're a very busy guy.
Yeah, but I had this real attitude. I still sort of do toward Apple and Mac, and it wasn't a positive attitude, and I don't want to get into it. But so the other thing was I was a founder of that company, and so it was our own money, and we were trying to grow this company from 3 people to 50 people, and so you had to buy your own equipment, basically.
Right.
You're buying it. If you didn't use the money on expensive equipment, you could get more salary, basically. So I was always PC-based. So, yeah, it probably was SoundForge. And
that's funny.
The only award that I've ever been called out directly for in my work came from the software, SPA, the Software Publisher Association, because they gave 3 Stooges, the Amiga version, an award that year.
That's nice. I'm glad the Amiga got something.
Yeah, me too.
That poor machine.
but that was fun. It was the Amiga was a really interesting machine. It had a interesting sound system. It was a bit difficult, but
oh really? The Paula was a not user friendly or developer friendly chip.
Well, you know, all it really was a looping DMA controller. There were 4 of them, right? So you could point it at a chunk of memory and say, "Play this," and when you get to the end, go back and play it again.
Gotcha.
Now, if you had a long stream, you could buffer up a series of buffers, right? And you could play a chunk, and when it gets to the end, you'd get an interrupt. You could say, okay, play the next chunk. And so you could play streams. But still, the machine wasn't big enough to really just play streams. You really needed to implement something sort of like a synthesizer on it.
And I don't remember for sure, but I bet you know the answer to this. I know that graphics required using chip RAM or chip memory for it, versus, faster, quote, quote, slow RAM. Did Paula have that same sort of restriction where you could only use chip memory for it, chip RAM?
Yeah, that detail escapes me now. I remember the names of the chips and I remember the distinction, and I don't remember if I was subject to that or not. I have a feeling that in slow RAM is where I put the body of my stuff and then I moved it to fast RAM on demand kind of thing, maybe.
Yeah.
That sounds about right. Yeah.
But, well, listen, I could really keep you here all day. but at some point, I guess we probably have to wrap this up.
Yeah.
Well, your phone's ringing.
You know, in a year, I'll probably still be here. We can do this again in a year.
I would definitely love, because we're going to probably split this up into 2 shows on my end, and I got so many more things that I want to talk to you about.
You can talk about Time Machine.
I know. I love Time Machine. That's one of my favorite pinballs. You know, just as an offside story, the listeners like this stuff too. I own a Bone Busters, which of course is a Gottlieb. And I was going to talk to you about the whole Ghostbusters, Bone Busters thing, which you may or may not know anything about because I think you were gone by then.
Yeah.
The first pinball machine that I actually really wanted to own, when I came up to myself and I said, "Hey, if you were to own a pinball machine, which one would it be?" And it would have been Time Machine.
Cool.
Which is fantastic. Now, that was superseded, I hate to say it because I know you didn't work on this project, by Black Knight 2000. Which, you know, I don't know about, maybe it probably pisses you off somewhere in the game because sound is your business. I thought that the audio experience of Black Knight 2000 was like the greatest thing ever. What do you think of that? I mean, what do you think of that,
I thought it was done terrifically well because he integrates that whole singing thing in there. I thought it was done really well. I like it. See, I had this challenge when I did my first piece with Steve. I did Spider-Man.
Right.
And, it took me a while to understand, because I don't work in Chicago.
Right.
Well, Steve was only there sometimes. He was commuting from California. And it took me a while to figure out what Steve wanted. Finally, I think I just went back and got a pin name version of Black Knight 2000 and listened to it.
I've got that.
Yeah, and that informed my, so this is what he wants.
Right.
Though I didn't, I didn't do that, but I mean, I knew where the energy, I knew what Steve needed to have.
Right.
So I went back to his previous work. And so Steve, when he was at Williams, would wander the halls, I think, with his guitar, or go and pick up a guitar, and he plays guitar, and he would go, play some riff and some thing, you know, and then the sound guy would put that into the project.
That's so funny. Multi-versatile dude, huh?
Yeah. I mean, he's also voice talent.
Really? See, I gotta do more research on him because I don't know enough about him, and I should.
Well, he's one of some of the famous voices in Mortal Kombat, or Steve.
No kidding. Yeah. See, I love Mortal Kombat too. So,
and some of the voices in his own game, I believe, are Steve. You know, pitch shifted, I think, but yeah.
Right. Well, listen, David, this has been incredible, and again, I could sit here and pick your brain forever. Definitely the next time we get together, we can talk more pinball. I know we talked more console computer stuff, but I have a lot of pinball fans, and they're going to want to hear your pinball stories.
Well, so. Yeah, there are a lot of pinball stories. Actually, I'm shocked now. Let's see, 13-5. I'm working on my 18th pinball now.
God, that's crazy.
It is crazy.
It's great, though. I mean, I'm so happy that pinball survived.
Yeah.
There was a time that I didn't think it would, but I'm glad. I'm glad that I'm glad we're getting more tables, and I'm glad that
there's a second manufacturer.
There's a second manufacturer.
Well, actually, there's a third, really. I don't know. There's a guy named John Papaduke who did the magical one for Williams Bally. He was a Bally pinball designer that ended up at Williams when Williams purchased Bally. And he's still around. Hmm. And in fact, well, did you see the Zizzle table, the Pirates of the Caribbean, the home version of Pirates of the Caribbean? There was one.
I did. You know, I saw the table, but I never got to play it. Yeah.
Yeah, well,
it was like a 2/3 size or something like that.
Oh, not even. Yeah, it was like $200. Yeah. But it's a pinball. I mean, it plays like a pinball. Well, John's the guy behind that.
Oh, okay.
And now he's designing custom. I don't know if they're custom, but really small numbers. Let's say less than 20. He's doing these builds of very expensive games for collectors, and he's done one. I haven't seen it, but I know he has. And so I don't know if he's ever going to get up into bigger quantities, but he's producing original pinball machines now as well. So
collectors love them.
Yeah, for collectors, there are now three sources of new machines.
That's fantastic.
Out there in the universe.
That's good.
It's bizarre. I'm shocked.
Me too. I mean, it gives me some hope for the human race, though, to be perfectly honest with you.
Yeah.
You know? That pinball can still survive.
Yeah, I fully expect. I mean, it's about time for me. I mean, there were other challenges. I clearly my career has been. I mean, it's been dominated recently by pinball, but I've done a lot more video than I have pin.
Yeah, and I want to ask you more questions, but I'm going to resist the urge, and I'm going to let you go back to your routine and me back to mine. And
yeah, I've got people piling up here in email.
I'm sorry.
Clients.
Yeah,
no,
I have a bad habit of dragging these things out, and they're so interesting. You guys are so interesting. So, hey, are you going to, speaking of which, real quick, before I let you go, Classic Gaming Expo, have you been to one of those?
I have not.
They were on hiatus for a couple of years. It's in Las Vegas, this year.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, they're at the newly remodeled, what's that one that's on the old strip, the big one? Just suddenly jumped out of my head. The one that's across from that big pavilion. I don't know what you know, Las Vegas.
I haven't been there in a long while. I mean, I used to almost live there because the coin-op shows were there 2 and 3 times a year.
Sure.
And
yeah.
So I used to go there a lot. And then when I got out of coin-op and was at Microsoft, I only went there a couple of times. And now that I'm working for myself out of my digital sweat lodge, I don't travel at all.
Right.
I don't get out much at all. So,
well, these guys, go ahead.
This virtual conversation is like the way I get out.
You know, I envy you because I actually have to leave the house sometimes, and I'd rather sometimes just sit at home and do things.
Yeah, anyway, I love, this is a filter on the new work that I will accept. I mean, if Valve or Bungie or one of the local companies here offered me a gig, I would probably go down to some office and work.
Right.
I wouldn't mind that commute because Seattle is a small metropolitan area, but I wouldn't relocate to work for anybody.
No.
And I don't see the need, frankly. I have a great studio here. I have broadband, and I have done 13 pinball machines, which is a difficult collaboration across many people, and they have to ship a 300-pound object to me.
Sure.
And these have all been very successful. So if I can do that, I can work on anybody's handheld, console, anything, you know, from my studio, as long as they've got broadband and an FTP site.
Well, look, you survived a phone deal with Disney doing that Pirates of the Caribbean stuff. So if you could survive that over the telephone, I think you're in good shape.
Oh, yeah. Well, all the voice. I've never been – no, I'm only once out of 13 projects have I ever been in a studio where the voice talent was.
Wow. Who was the voice talent?
Oh, that was the guy. I happened to be in Chicago, and when some of the pirate stuff was done, and I'm trying to think. He's a wacky local Chicago guy who's done a lot of weird voicing for pinball machines. Fred, I can't think of his last name. He's just Fred.
He's Fred.
But otherwise, all these other people that I've worked with, Seth MacFarlane, the doctor from CSI, Colonel Quaritch from Avatar, all these actors, they're in a studio somewhere in America, or not even necessarily.
Right.
And I'm on the phone, and while I can't do the audio engineering because the quality's not good enough, I have to rely on somebody else to do that. But hey, we paid for a studio and an audio engineer.
Right.
They'll record it, so it's not clipping. That's really my only requirement.
Yeah.
But I can direct the readings. I can hear what they're doing, and I can suggest to them, do this, do that, do the other thing.
Sure.
So that's possible. You know, there's no reason this thing, you've got to be in an office so that we can drag you to a weekly status meeting. I'm not there.
And you are fortunate you are not.
I know I am. But, you know, I worked at Microsoft for 7 years. Trust me.
Oh, well, I have so many questions for you regarding Microsoft, but that's going to have to wait for another time.
All right.
Well, listen, this has been fantastic. Thank you again for taking over 2 hours of your time to talk to me and my listeners. It's been a treat.
Thank you. I very much enjoyed it. I was unaware of your site. I don't stick my head up and spend much time doing anything but writing stuff. And so I've been to your site in preparation for this. I listened to a couple of the old shows, and it was very interesting. I like it.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Well, I will get you out of here. This is Shane R. Monroe with Retro Gaming Radio. I am here with David Thiel, giving us the scoop on being an interactive audio engineer. Fascinating stories, and I know there's many more where that came from.
Well, thanks, Shane. I had a great time.
Thank you so much, and we will see you next time. We'd like to thank David Thiel for being with us right here on Retro Gaming Radio. Amazing talent, remarkable guy, great stories, gave us tons of his time. We're really appreciative of that. If you missed last month we had a lot of discussion on the computer console gaming side of it, where this month was more pinball. So if you're more interested in the classic gaming side of sound engineering, you might want to check out the December 2011 show, because that's where we had David Thiel's first interview. Again, thanks a lot, David, for being with us. All right, we have a huge bits and bytes on an already large show, so let's jump right into it. Let's see. First up, we got sent from Nicholas. Nicholas sends over the Retrode 2 Retro Gaming Adapter. Now, what this guy is, I've done some research on this thing. I don't have one yet, but I'm going to lay my paws on one and review it for you. Well, this is a small little hardware device. It has two cartridge slots on it. It looks like it'll accept Super Nintendo and Genesis games. So it'll hold the two of them. And essentially, you plug this in. They have actual ports on the side to plug in a real controller. So you plug in a real Genesis controller or a real Super Nintendo controller, plug the cartridge in. It dumps the cartridge to internal memory and mounts it as a USB drive right on your computer, right? So it mounts itself as a generic USB drive, which is perfect. That should work on any operating system. And then you also have a keyboard type driver, right? So the controllers that you plug in are translated into some sort of a keyboard or human interface device, and then you simply load your emulator of choice for Super Nintendo or Genesis, and now you've got an interface to load real cartridges, real controllers, and play them on your emulator. Sounds like a very interesting hybrid solution. I'm curious to see just how well that works. And it's got apparently enough ports that you can have four players playing at the same time. So that sounds very interesting to me. And let's see if they've got a price on their site here. Looks like it's going to be $85. So it's going to be a little on the pricey side to get into it. There's a few people they'll be selling them in different regions. But apparently they're going to be shipping, Michigan, Germany, and Japan. So it looks like you have a few different outlets to choose from. And word on the street is that these should be available even as you're listening to this. So let's see real quick. I'm going to pop in here and just save you guys some clicks. I'm going to see if the StoneAgeGamer.com, which is apparently the local place here in the States that has them. They're selling them for $90 with free shipping. And let's see. It appears that they look to be in stock. It doesn't say that they're out of stock. So, shipping mid-February, so they're on back order. So if you're interested in this guy, definitely check it out. Retrode 2, and it is a Super Nintendo Genesis interface. Plug your real cartridges in, plug your real controllers in, use an emulator on your USB-based PC, and you're good to go. I'm guessing that this would probably work on a Transformer or on an Android tablet that's equipped with a USB port. We'll find out at some point. We'll get one. We'll get one and we'll try it out. Okay, next up, like I said, it's a long list here. Next up, Alex J. Lopez sent in, my producer, sent in an article about Atari is finally cracking down on the App Store, the Apple App Store, claiming copyright infringement on hundreds of iOS games. Now, we all knew that this was happening. We all knew that this was coming. I'm not sure that there's any real surprise that Atari is starting to smack down on mobile devices because, as you heard me say, the mobile will be the next platform for retro gaming. So let's see. Essentially, here's Atari's stance on it. For companies like Atari, our intellectual property portfolio is our most valuable asset. While we have great respect for the indie developer community and greatly appreciate the enthusiasm they have for our renowned properties, we need to vigorously protect our intellectual property and ensure it is represented in highly innovative games. We've been actively engaging in numerous established and up-and-coming developers to help us reimagine our iconic franchises, and outside app developers have already helped us produce two top 10 mobile game successes in Asteroids Gunner and Breakout Boost. We look forward to furthering developing strong relationships with indie developments, blah, 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 blah. So, bottom line is, you can't just steal this stuff, you know. They're not coming down on emulators. They're coming down on people who are basically taking their game and calling it excellent Mario instead of Super Mario, and they're just basically cloning the game. It's hard not to get pissed off about how that's going on, especially when the copyright holders are obviously still working with the properties. Now, granted, they need to be releasing the originals first. I mean, if you're going to release a remake, a re-envisioning of Asteroids, such as Asteroids Gunner or Breakout Boost, and I haven't seen either one of these games, if you're going to make something like that, then you need to release the originals too. You can't leave those things locked up because that's what we really want. That's what the emulation and classic gaming community want. We want the originals. Yeah, you go ahead and exploit the property to your heart's content, but after you give us the original ones, then you can take the property off and do whatever the hell you want with it. That's my outlook on it. If you're going to do that, if you're going to go after any developers for basically taking games that we want, then you need to produce them yourself. I'm happy to pay. Don't worry, I don't expect it for free. Just make me the original Asteroids, and I'll be good. I don't think that the companies understand that that's what these people are trying to do. The people, not everybody, but I think a lot of the independent developers are trying to recreate these games because there's no legal form of them out there, and it's obvious that they don't care, right? If you're not going to release a property that you own, then, you know, someone's going to release it, and then you're going to have to go after them, and then you find there's a market, then you release it, and you make money, and the guy that stole it from you makes nothing. That's sort of the way it goes. I'm just saying that I'm a big believer in exploiting your IP only if you give proper benefit to the original IP that drove it. Kind of my thought. So, that's what Atari's up to. And Atari's turning into a pure mobile device company now, which I think is the smartest thing Atari's ever done. They're brilliant for doing that. Yeah, so they have to go over, they have to go against the people who are taking that property and moving on it. So I actually support what Atari's doing in this case. I think it's a very smart move. Next up, Marty from Sleepy Eyed Films, big fan of the show. He's been a fan of the show for a long time. He's also a huge Dragon's Lair fan. He's been working on a Dragon's Lair documentary for God knows how long. It's been forever. And he approached me with this, I think the last time Retrograding Radio was still airing, which was several years ago. And he basically wants to interview the guys. He wants to do the definitive documentary. And I respect that because I'm a big Dragon's Lair and Don Bluth fan. So anyway, he wrote me this last month and let me know that the documentary's still alive. He's got a Facebook page. You know, I'm a huge Facebook fan, you know. He's got a Facebook page. But for him, I'm going to let it promote. I'm going to promote it. A Facebook page that gives you all the information you might possibly want to know. And he does have media, a couple of, I think he's got a teaser trailer up there and some more information. So good stuff, good stuff. The guy's doing a good public service trying to keep Dragon's Lair alive and keeping the legacy of Dragon's Lair alive, because that's the important part. Rob D, regular contributor to Retro Gaming Radio's Bits and Bytes segment, sends over an interesting deal. Super Kid Icarus, play a 16-bit game in your browser through the magic of HTML5. This is a fan recreation of the popular Kid Icarus title. And right here in your browser window, you can launch and play the game, Super Kid Icarus, subtitled An Angel Land Story Retold. So that's pretty neat. I like the concept. I mean, I'm assuming, you know, Nintendo's going to come along and smack him down at some point. So you might want to get over and play it now while he can. But yeah, this is really neat. I like seeing games written in classic style, and especially extending or reaching past the particular property. I don't think that's a bad thing at all, as long as, you know, the original IP holder isn't going to jump all over you. It's a creepy way, creepy thing going on these days with IP and copyright, I'll tell you. So, this is interesting. Alex sent me over this as well. Now, I've never played this Cannibalt? Cannibalt? I'm assuming that's how you pronounce it. I have no idea. Cannibalt is much like the game I reviewed, Bit Trip Runner. I'm not sure who came first. I'm not going to speculate who started the genre. But this is what they, sort of a single button game, right? You've got a character and he's running across the screen. You can't stop him. All you can do is make him do something to keep him moving. It's kind of in a weird way, sort of like Dragon's Lair, right? Anyway, this Cannibalt was huge. I mean, huge. And Cannibalt sort of featured retro graphics and, you know, all that sort of thing. It was very popular, apparently. Huge game. I never played it. I don't understand how that worked out, but I did not. Anyway, they made, get this, a Commodore 64 port of this. Now, anything Commodore 64, you know I'm in. They made it into an actual cartridge. You can buy an actual cartridge and play this game, like, almost, it looks identical. I mean, I looked at the two videos of the original and the C64 Abalt, Siggy 64 and Abalt. That's a weird name. And they look great. It looks fantastic. I mean, it looks dead on. And it's a real cartridge. So for those of you who still have original hardware and you want to play this game, you can play it on your original hardware. It's fantastic. So pretty neat. Pretty neat stuff. We'll send you to the shop that's selling that cartridge. And they got video and pictures and stuff like that. It looks like they want about 20 pounds. So what is that? 1.5. So about $35. You know, it's a little on the pricey side. But hey, what a deal. You actually get a cartridge. You know, it's not just some digital download you're paying full retail price for. So that's really neat. Check it out. I might have to actually dig the... I have to actually dig the game up on the mobile platform and try it out. It looks cool. Next up, this is from actually, I don't know if you would want me to disclose my source. Friend of the show, works for a magazine. I'll say that. Big friend of the show. He's helped us out a lot. Sent me over something about a month and a half ago. And I didn't want to actually talk about it until there was a little bit more stuff going on. So, with the item. What this is, this is the Game Gadget. And you'll, again, it'll appear on your, in your browser if you're on the, Retro Gaming Radio Plus TV site. And I'm telling you, if you're listening to this in your car, maybe slot off some time and go back and check the show out in the RGR Plus TV format, because you miss a lot of this stuff. Anyway, the Game Gadget is supposed to be, okay, work with me on this one. They want this to be the iPod of retro gaming. In other words, capable hardware that can play an assortment of different products, real controls, right? Real controls, and USB, modern type stuff, right? I was just going to play this video and see if they had anything that they wanted to show us. D-pad. Plenty of buttons, you know, nice technology. They look like they're using nice technology, and they want you to buy, like on an app store, download classic games. Now, this is the sort of thing that starts to worry me. They got shoulder buttons too. This is the sort of thing that worries me. A lot of these don't do very well, these sort of ideas. It also has an SD card slot, which is fantastic, which means you should be able to sideload your own games on there. Now, I don't know how well that's going to work out, but if they're going to put some protection in there to keep you from doing that or what, my sources say that that's probably not going to be the case, that you'll be able to play whatever you want. Anyway, the screen looks very nice in this demo video. That you can play. It's sort of like a GP2X type deal. You know, you can play music and video, do media, pictures, that sort of thing. A little ebook text reader, right? I'm just going through what they're showing. And then, of course, they'll have their own built-in emulators to handle the types of games that you can download and pick up. It looks like a very nice little unit. Of course, it's not out yet. And I guess originally it was supposed to be in time for Christmas. So this is a pretty decent setback, whatever's holding them up. Now, we've seen tons of these types of brilliant-looking gadgets come and never go, right? The Pandora, we've seen numerous GP2Xs come through. We've seen a lot of different things that just didn't quite work out. I think what they're banking on is the concept that they can get publishers behind this and say, listen, look, you're selling your Atari games on Android or on Apple, iOS, and hey, we got another device for you to sell games on. Here's the store. Here's how we'll cut the money. What do you think? Can we have the legal rights to the ROMs, blah, blah, blah. So we'll see how it goes. I think the Game Gadget has potential, but like so many gadgets before it, I think they're fighting a serious uphill battle in making that useful and profitable. Andy J. sent something in here called High Score Musical. And it looks like they're looking for some funding for this thing. Essentially, they're trying to make a musical based around classic arcade and home computer games. Right? So I'm going to send you to their site. I haven't had an opportunity to delve very deeply in here, but it looks like it's, you know, they got their heart in the right direction, at least for stuff that I'm interested in. Here we go. Let's see if there's a little write-up here. High School Musical will feature live musicians alongside authentic 80s computer sounds to bring alive the feeling of being huddled over a ZX Spectrum or C64 and then wasting piggy banks full of pence pieces in the local arcade, obviously foreign. That's okay, though. A musical for anybody who's lost their last life and found their first love. Lost their last life. Not sure what that means. But, you know, watch the video. They got a little trailer, and it sounds like a pretty neat deal. They're going to cut a CD and the whole bit. So, hey, if nothing else, you got to give people credit for trying to move forward with something classic gaming related and something artsy. I mean, we talked about video games as art an episode or two ago, and I like the concept. I love music. I love audio, especially Commodore 64 music. So I'm going to be watching this close and see how it goes. So give that a look. See what you guys think. And if anybody has more information or, you know, wants to add their two cents in, please send me something in. I talk a lot about Castles and Coasters. It's pretty much the last place in Phoenix that has a really large retro classic arcade collection of games to play, right? So I talk a lot about Castles and Coasters. Well, somebody was helpful enough. Let's see. Let me scroll down here. Mark Minch wrote in about the Galloping Ghost Arcade. This is in Chicago. And these guys have got an insane set of games here. They got a website. We'll bring it up. And they it looks like they have regular events. This is one of those pay one fee, go in and play games for free the rest of the day, which is actually perfect for me. That would be what I would want to do, who wants to run tokens and all that stuff. So $15 gets you in all day. All machines are set to free play, no quarters or coins or tokens, right? And it looks like they got ranked tournaments. They're constantly adding new games. Mappy was just added to the arcade on the 19th, right? So they're keeping things pretty fresh over there. And let me just poke through here, and I'll give these guys a good plug here. Let's see what their arcade game list is. Here's a list of games they currently have running. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'm going to poke through this list and give you guys a couple. Oh, my God, this list just doesn't stop. Here's some good stuff. They got I'm going to do the retro stuff here. Xevious, Xenophobe, X-Men, Wizard of War. Hey, that's for you, Chris. Warlords, all the Versus games it looks like. Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3. Okay, that's not that old, but Tron, Time Pilot. Let's see, which Time Pilot? Oh, both Time Pilots. Time Soldiers. Tetris, Thunderblade, haven't seen that in a while. Oh, Terminator 2, Judgment Day, Tempest, of course. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Super Zaxxon, Super Puzzle Fighter Turbo. Looks like tons of Street Fighter stuff. Star Wars, Superman, Splatterhouse, Star Wars Trilogy, Star Wars, the original. Simpsons, Shinobi, Scramble, of course. God only knows what game's actually playing on it, though. Oh, Rastan, Punch-Out, sweet. Popeye, a lot of the games we talked about earlier in the show. Pac-Man, of course. Outrun. Oh, Ninja Warriors. That's a cool cabinet. It's huge. All the Mortal Kombats are represented. Missile Command. Oh, I could read this list all day long. That's just a little segment of the list. And then they've got a list of games that they're looking to add in the near future, and they give you a list of the games that they have but are currently under repair. Let's see if there's anything that's under repair that would be super cool. A Gauntlet's on the way. Marble Madness, Moonwalker, Mortal Kombat Trilogy, Paperboy, that'd be cool. Kicks, Star Wars Empire Strikes Back. So, hey, these guys look pretty cool. If you're in the Chicago area or you go there for business or whatever, this looks like a pretty damn cool place to go. I mean, I never go to Chicago, so I'll never get to see this place, but I know a lot of people do. Let's see. What else do we have here? One of the things that I wasn't sure where I was going to end up putting this, so I put it in both spots. The famous entertainer piece, for those of maybe who skipped through the 30th anniversary segment above for the commentary, I've talked a lot in the past about a great version of the entertainer that was played on the Commodore 64. It wasn't a SID file or a music file, per se, not a .sid or a .mus file, but it was actually a program that you would load and run, and it would come up and it'd say, listen, it's going to be a while, it's 3.5 minutes wait time. And what it would do is it would sit there and poke music into memory, into these giant arrays, and it was the most killer version of the entertainer ever. Now, let me tell you something about this particular arrangement. Good luck finding anything on it. I've been spending the last like 5 to 10 years trying to dig this piece up. And there are, I mean, entertainer is like one of the most overdone pieces of computer music of all time. But this one is almost impossible to find. Good luck finding it. So I took a different approach this time. I went out looking for it for the 30th anniversary. I wanted to talk about Commodore 64 stuff that I loved, and I wanted an opportunity to find it. And so I went searching, and finally I went over to the Lemon 64. Lemon 64 is a great Commodore 64 site. They also have a Lemon Amiga. I've mentioned them before in the past, but always nice to give them a plug. They've been around a long time. They've got huge databases of games, and videos, and assets, and a huge community. So I went to the forums, and I posted about it. And within a few days, Carson, who goes by Gyro or Gyromite, he lives over in Louisville, Kentucky. Carson came and said, listen, I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm going, really? Because I'm starting to think I made it up. Because if you search the internet high and low to try to find more information about, even about the thing, not find the actual file, but about it, I found one reference from like 8 years ago. Some guy mentioned it as one of the most unusual and cool arrangements of the entertainer he'd ever seen. But he's been out, I haven't seen, he wasn't on that forum anymore, and he wasn't available. I'm sure he didn't even have it. He just was reminiscing about it like me. And so I posted it, and after two or three exchanges, and I said, no, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this, it's not that. You know, it's not a SID file, it's actually an executable. Finally, Carson showed up and said, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm going, yes! And he's like, thanks to an archival project that he did a while back of moving everything to an archival format, he was able to reproduce it. He pulled it off, and originally it was on a tape he had laying around, right? He pulled it off, and he uploaded it, and I finally have the entertainer piece that I want. And that's huge. That was one of the long-lost things that I was looking for in my Commodore 64 memorabilia. The other thing was trying to figure out which of the colored floppy disks, what product came on the first colored floppy disk that I saw. And I actually had to go out and reach out to the Google Plus community, and several people chimed in, and through a little bit of knowledge and some sharing, a little bit of poking in the back of the noggin, I found out what product it was. I forgot it already. It was a disc copier. It was a disc master or something to that effect. And its whole job was to, of course, copy software. But it came on like the coolest disc. It had these really cool like neon colors. And it's like, it was the neatest thing I'd ever seen. No one had ever seen a colored floppy until that point. At least I had. None of my group had. So those were the things that I had been searching for, was the entertainer and that particular product, the program that came on that colored disc. So the end of an era, I managed to put a couple things to bed. And it's also the end of our Bits and Bytes segment. Remember, Bits and Bytes is fueled by notes and emails from folks just like you. Join us over at Google Plus. You can join us over there at the Retro Gaming Radio page, post it up there. Or go over and go to the website. There's plenty of contact information there. And finally, you can just email us directly, bitsandbytes@retrogamingradio.com. We look at them every single month. And if you did submit something and it's not in here, it's not because it may not be in here or I rejected it or something. It simply means that I try to kind of group things together. And there's a method to the madness. And if you didn't see your submission this month, it'll probably be along next month. Anyway, I hope that that'll wrap it up for Bits and Bytes. Hope you guys enjoyed it. And stick around. Lots more show ahead. We don't have a ton of time for reviews this month simply because the show is just so packed with material, but I did want to take an opportunity to discuss Dragon's Lair on the Android platform. Now, Dragon's Lair has been ported a gajillion times to a gajillion systems with, shall we say, some arcade accuracy, and some of them have just plain been games that really aren't Dragon's Lair at all. Some of the 8-bit platforms like NES and the Commodore 64, Dragon's Lair was changed into a platformer type adventure game. Of course, that's not really the Dragon's Lair we've all come to know and love. But over the years, we have seen some attempts to make a very close arcade accurate translation of Dragon's Lair. We all know about the Daphne emulator. The Daphne emulator is an actual LaserDisc game emulator. In other words, it emulates the software, it emulates the disc seeks and everything else, and it plays back actual video from the LaserDisc. This is still, to date, the absolute 100% most accurate way to play this game, other than being on the actual Dragon's Lair arcade machine. However, recently I did do a review up on Monroe World that, with regards to the Wii version, the Dragon's Lair trilogy. Frankly, to date, the Wii version is the best version to play at home. If you can't play Daphne, then the Wii version is definitely the best. It has the most accuracy. It's still not completely accurate. It's got great looking video. It's not HD, but neither was the arcade machine, right? So, if I had to recommend a version to play outside of the arcade game and outside of Daphne, it would be the Wii version. But not everybody has a Wii. Some of us have these nice, clean Asus Transformer tablets or a Thrive or an Iconia. So how does Dragon's Lair fare here on the Android platform? Android has finally started coming into its own, right? We've got a large percentage of the market share now. It's some 50-something percent, I guess, against Apple's 28%, whatever it is. In any event, Android is finally in the lead, and developers are starting to move their content over to Android. So how does Dragon's Lair fare on the Android platform? Dragon's Lair has always been about two things. The beautiful, gorgeous video, penned by Don Bluth, master animator Don Bluth, and the accuracy of the moves and timing involved with those moves. Because really what Dragon's Lair was an interactive movie. You kept the movie playing by tapping a direction or tapping the sword button to make the on-screen character, Dirk the Daring, do what he needed to do to keep the movie playing. Should you fail to accomplish that task, the video would change and you would see a death and you would lose a life. And you'd have to repeat the process again until you got it right, or in some cases, it would skip ahead to the next scene so you could continue to play without having to die over and over and over again because you didn't know what to do in that last scene. Dragon's Lair, again, holds a huge special place in my heart. And as such, I'm a little more, or should I say a little less, willing to let things slide. Right? You guys know that I'll always give you the straight scoop on a Dragon's Lair game. And the Android version, while remarkably decent in many areas, does fail in several other areas. So let's talk about it. First, let's talk about the visuals of the Android version. The best part about this particular port is, depending on your device, be it a cell phone, a tablet, whatever, when you download the app, it downloads the video files for you to play the game. Based on your device, it downloads a different set of videos. For example, if you're downloading on, say, Droid Bionic, you're going to get a different set of files than if you are accessing the application with the Asus Transformer or the Galaxy Tab or the Motorola Zoom. You get a different set of video files based on the resolution and the quality of the video that your device can handle. This is fantastic. This is the first time that this sort of thing has been done with the Dragon's Lair property. I think it's fantastic. You buy it once and you get it on every device in the proper resolution with the proper quality. Huge thumbs up to the boys over Digital Leisure for doing that. It's fantastic. You only have to download the videos once. There's no streaming of video involved. So once it's on your system, you can play it without being connected to the internet. Once you start up the game from your device, you are presented with a very nice interactive menu that lets you watch the trailer or get instructions on the game, look at your high scores, and change a couple of different options. We're going to get to the options in just a couple of minutes here. And, of course, play the game. You're also allowed to have a save state. You get one save state. If you're in the middle of a game and you get a phone call, you're in the middle of a game and you hit the home button on your tablet, the game is frozen in time, and you can return to where you left off next time you run the application. So that's perfect, right? That's a good way to do it, because Dragon's Lair takes about 20, 25 minutes to get through all the way. And, you know, you don't want to have to always do that in one setting, especially when you're on a mobile device, right? You don't know how long you're going to be waiting at the doctor's office, so you throw down a little Dragon's Lair, and you got to be ready to move. Dragon's Lair used a four-direction joystick to actually enter taps. It's not like you could hold the joystick down and make Dirk run anywhere. You tapped up to indicate Dirk should continue moving up or down, left or right, and you had one sword button. So four directions and a button. Now, as per normal, I'm not a huge fan of virtual on-screen controls, especially when you have to do things quickly. And accuracy comes into play. Dragon's Lair requires fast action and insane levels of accuracy, meaning that you need to be able to push that direction quickly, and you need to be able to change from going, you know, forward to immediately going left or right or down based on the moves required by the scene that you're playing. Unfortunately, the touchscreen is not a very tactile device, which means, of course, that you're going to make mistakes. That makes this game harder to play than on any other platform. Even on the Wii, you can use the D-pad. And the D-pad is easy enough to make quick, fast action responses from one direction to another. That's a problem, right? And those of you who are diehard fans of the game are going to have problems getting some of those quick sequences of moves in using these virtual D-pads. Fortunately, the boys over at Digital Leisure have provided Xperia-ready play for this game, which means if you have an Xperia device or you have some method of joystick plugged into your tablet, or you use a tool such as USB BD Joystick Center, you can throw a Wiimote controller, turn it on, hook it up to Bluetooth, and then remap the controls into Dragon's Lair. So when I play Dragon's Lair on my tablet, I'm playing with the Wii Remote. That way I can use the D-pad and a physical button for a sword. That totally changes how well this game plays. You're no longer making silly mistakes trying to make different moves or quick series of moves. That's the way I would recommend playing it. If you're in a pinch and that's all you've got and you've only got the screen, sorry to hear that. The good news is Digital Leisure was very ready to help me get this fixed in the first release of Dragon's Lair. Maybe some of you looked at the first release and that was it, and you haven't been updating your copy, whatever. In the first release, the sword button wasn't properly mapped to a button, which means if you had a joystick plugged into your tablet and you were using the joystick, it would register the moves, but no button would actually complete a sword action. I fired a note over to those guys, and they were very willing to help. They got the joystick working. I got some demo builds from them. I helped them make sure that it worked properly. I mapped all the buttons out. Everything worked great. So they were very helpful in that. And there were some other things that I assisted them on as well. Now, one thing that Digital Leisure is less moving on regarding to accuracy. Accuracy, to me, is the most important part of reliving your past. If you've ever played a Jak Pacific arcade controller, you know, you plug it into the TV. You know, we're not big fans of that around here. But you go and you buy a Pac-Man, portable Pac-Man game. You plug it into your TV. It's got Pac-Man logos all over the controls. It's got a real joystick and a real button. Well, you don't need a button for Pac-Man, but you get the idea. Unfortunately, it doesn't really use pure emulation. And those people who have played Pac-Man before, they know that this isn't really Pac-Man. The patterns aren't right. The ghosts don't move the same. So it looks like Pac-Man and it sounds like Pac-Man. But in the end, a real Pac-Man fan is going to find problem with it. And this is pretty much the same deal with Dragon's Lair. And this is on Dragon's Lair no matter what platform you play it on. Whether you're playing it on the PC or on the Wii or the Blu-ray version, whichever one you're playing on, you are going to run into inconsistencies and inaccuracies by moves and by timing. Sometimes these are very, very minor. Other times they're very, very major. And over the years, I have butted heads with Digital Leisure on several occasions with regards to accuracy in the game. In some cases, they have tightened up the accuracy and have done a very good job of implementing some of the changes that I've made. However, as time moves forward, I think they're a little less interested in providing pure accuracy as they are to get the game in the hands of as many people as they can. And after all, they are a business, and that's their job is to make money. And I get that. Take 10 people who know what Dragon's Lair is and have played Dragon's Lair, and you put this game in front of them, and maybe one of them is going to say, hey, wait a minute, that's not right. That's not right. How come I couldn't do that? But, you know, I made that move. I don't understand why I didn't take it. That sort of thing. You're going to get 1 out of 10, right? They're not interested in catering to the 10%. For those of us who are the 10 percentile, we need to get Daphne running on the PC. What we really need is to get the Daphne team to get a port of Daphne onto the Android platform, which seems like a no-brainer to me. I mean, it's an open-source type platform. It's right in line with the developer's sort of mentality on keeping this game alive, preservation, that sort of thing. So I don't understand why we don't have one for Android yet. With dual-core and quad-core processors coming, there's absolutely no reason why a tablet could not easily pump out Daphne with any problems at all. So that's my plea. That's what I'm hoping to see in the coming years, is I hope to see Daphne itself get ported so we have full accuracy. So just how bad are the accuracy issues within Dragon's Lair? Well, this version of Dragon Slayer, much like every other version of Dragon Slayer, for the most part, that Digital Leisure puts out, contains an arcade version and a home version. Now, the home version's pretty much their creation, so accuracy and compatibility and moves and timing, you know what? I can't say anything about that. That's their put together. They've created that as an alternative to the arcade version. So that's cool. So I can't say anything about that. But when it comes down to the arcade version, I dare say nobody knows Dragon's Lair as well as I do. Now, as per all the home versions of the arcade game, this is built around the F2 ROM set. Those of you who are big Daphne fans, those of you who have played a lot of Dragon's Lair, who are into it, you know exactly what F2 means. Unfortunately, as with F2 translations, there's a lot of not quite correct deals. A lot of the things that I came down on the Wii version for are also present here in this version. One of the first thing you're going to notice is the fire ropes, right? Most of you know that on the fire ropes, on the real arcade version of Dragon's Lair, you don't have to wait for the platform to start pulling back and almost knocking you into the fire before you jump over and grab the first rope. In the arcade version, you can grab the rope the first time it swings over towards Dirk. I don't think I've ever seen a home version. Maybe the Wii version did it. I don't remember. That'd be tapping my head a little bit. I don't remember ever seeing a home version where that was done. And that bothers me. I mean, that's the first scene out of the box. I mean, it sets the tone for the rest of the game. Oh, I couldn't jump on the fire ropes. What's going on? A lot of people who played Dragon's Lair didn't even know that the platform would pull back. They just assumed the first move was to get on that rope as soon as possible. Right? F2 ROM set also had a randomization splattering of the first scene that you went into. Sometimes it was the fire rope, sometimes it was the building, you know, the self-building wall. And these sort of timing and random ability type things are what you see in this game. You come up and it's like, wow, the fire ropes, fire ropes. You play it five times in a row, fire ropes, fire ropes, fire ropes. Oh, there's the crumbling wall. Go to the emulator, boot it up. Every other game, every third game starts with the crumbling wall. Again, these are not things that 90% of the public are going to see. But 80% of the public doesn't care about Dragon's Lair to begin with. So what you end up having is 20% of the people who do care about Dragon's Lair, but of that 20%, 50% don't care about the accuracy. So at least 50% of the people of the 20% of the population that actually care about Dragon's Lair actually care about the accuracy. So that's kind of how it works out. It seems like a low number when you say 10%, but when you think of 50% of the 20%, it becomes a bigger number. There are tons of other little things. Now, I could sit here and go scene by scene and tell you all the inaccuracies. There's enough that I'm telling you right now, if you are a purist, okay, expect this version to piss you off. If all you want is the Dragon's Lair experience, and you are not a diehard fan, and you are just a casual player, this version is going to do you just fine. Let me give you a couple more of the inaccuracies, just so you have an idea what we're talking about. One of the other inaccuracies deals with the rapids, right? You're in that sort of brownish-orange water. In the rapids, there's a small vein of lighter-colored water as you're flying through the rapids. On the arcade game, you could use one of two input methods. You could either hit the direction of the rapid, which would be right or left, or you could tap forward about the time you were right in line with the rapids. In the Android version, you can't do that. You have to move the direction first. You can't go forward or backward. It's been a little while since I've played it. Suffice to say, though, these are the sort of things that make people crazy. The Lizard King, right? The Lizard King has two different ways you can take him down. The Lizard King also has some very unique timing windows. In other words, as you're running down the path and the Lizard King's chasing you with a mace, and then you're basically following the melting pot, the little pot that has the gold in it. You're essentially following it down the hallway to get the gold and to get your sword back, right? Because the sword got taken by the little pot. As you reach an intersection, the pot runs by you, and you move the direction that the pot went. If you don't, then you get brained by the Lizard King. The Circle of Life. You get beamed by the Lizard King, and he drags you off, and you die. One of the things that I loved so much about the Lizard King scene is the fact that you can wait a long time on some of the intersections. As the you approach the intersection, the little gold chest goes running by, and the Lizard King comes up behind you. He whips the mace up, and before he swings, you have to move. You can wait a long time in the arcade game. I mean, you can wait almost until the mace pops you on the head before you move, and you can get away with it. It'll take the move, and you'll continue. On this version of it, you have to move considerably faster, which breaks my rhythm. There are some people, believe it or not, that can actually play Dragon's Lair without watching the video. They can play entirely by sound. With those types of sound cues, your mind is entrenched in a particular series of moves based on video and audio timings. This completely throws me. I die almost every time I play on the Android because I am so tuned to playing the Lizard King level a certain way that I'll die, right? There are several other inaccuracies that are right about in that vein. And you'll find as you play that you'll run across them and they will inevitably piss you off as a diehard Dragon's Lair fan. But that's not to say, though, that there aren't positive aspects of this game. The ability to take this with you, the ability to get it on any of your platforms once you've purchased it. On my tablet, on the Asus Transformer, I have an HDMI out. So I can literally take my tablet over to my 46-inch Toshiba, plug it in, and I can be playing Dragon's Lair on the couch with my Wii remote on a giant screen. That's pretty cool, right? And all of this I can't remember the price of the game. It might have been $10, something like that. But you got to figure, they're shoveling you a lot of bandwidth, right? That's how I look at it. There's a bandwidth consideration, and apparently piracy sucks down a lot of that. And I understand it, right? There's a lot of things that there's a lot of cost considerations. But hey, that's pretty much, you know, one of the cheapest versions to date, right? I believe on the DSiWare version was somewhere around $8, something like that. And that sounds about right. I mean, it's not what I would call super high resolution on the DS, right? On here, you're getting actual HD video. Correction, it's $5. $5 for Dragon's Lair, and that's not bad. You know, that's actually, I think, cheaper than it was on the DSi. So the price is decent. The simulation of the moves and the techniques, like I said, I'm never happy. Unless it's 100% accurate, I'm going to continue to cry and whine about it. And the truth is I've had to come to terms and make peace with myself that we're simply not going to see Dragon's Lair done 100% right without getting Daphne ported to whatever device it is that you want to play on. And that's too bad. I think that that this is the sort of thing that falls under preservation and accuracy and realism in emulation, especially nostalgia-type emulation like this, these period pieces. I believe that accuracy is one of the top-notch things that should be worked on. Great. I'm so happy that they made high resolution copies of the prints and that we have a high resolution version of the game to play. I love that. Yeah, that's great. But I would be happier playing a standard definition version like on the Wii and having it being accurate than to have, you know, high resolution graphics, which we didn't even have at the arcade way back when we first played it. So it's $5. Do I recommend it? Depends on the kind of Dragon's Lair person you are. Do you have a passing familiarity with Dragon's Lair? This will probably do just fine for you. Were you playing Daphne every day for a year after you got a hold of the emulator? This is probably going to piss you off. However, I would like to point out, as always, that supporting your platform of choice isn't always about 100% customer satisfaction, right? I paid for Dragon's Lair. I probably could have gotten a review copy. I didn't have to pay for it. But my point is, I want to support the Android platform. I want to show Digital Leisure, yes, this platform is viable. Yes, you're going to make money. And yes, please port Space Ace. Please don't make Space Ace with Blue Energizer video like you did on the Wii. I have no idea where that came from. But if I get Space Ace on the Android and it's got blue colored Energizer, I'm going to be pissed. Just so you're forewarned and forearmed. that I will be less generous when it comes to Space Ace, because Space Ace to me is, it's my favorite. It's my favorite of Don Bluth's games. Everyone thinks I'm a Dragon's Lair fanatic, but in reality, Space Ace is my favorite of the Laserdisc games. So, $5 Digital Leisure. It's available at the Android Market. Just remember, it's a, like a 22 meg download, so it's huge, but you also will have to download all of the video files, and believe me, that can take a decent amount of time, especially if you're downloading high-resolution ones for the tablet. So, again, Dragon's Lair Digital Leisure on the Android Market, $5, not too bad. I'd say probably 90% accurate in emulation, 10% not so much. Again, if you're looking for the ultimate experience, it's only available in one place. If you don't have the arcade machine, you're going to have to get Daphne. You're going to have to play that. If that doesn't work out for you, I would recommend the Wii version. That's still the best. And if you need it on the go and you have, say, a Nintendo DSi or DSi XL, it's also available there on their marketplace. And it's actually a fairly decent version. It's got the same sort of similar inconsistencies with it. But, you know, it, depending on what you've got to play it on, Dragon's Lair is pretty much available for you anywhere. All right, a quick update. Zen Pinball, we reviewed that recently on the show, and Zen Pinball is available for pretty much every platform. It comes in as Pinball FX on the consoles. But Zen Pinball was recently released for Android, and they've added a couple new tables since the review. The best of the new tables that they've added is one called Excalibur, which incidentally segues into my next point. Zen Pinball was just released for the Nintendo 3DS as a download from the eShop. That's pretty cool. So you get the game and the tables for the five bones. You have four tables and the pinball game for $5. So it's basically, what, $1.25 a table. And that's great. That's a great price. And it is fantastic. It is beautiful to play these on the 3DS. The screen's a little small, but the 3D is incredible. If you're a huge fan of Zen Pinball, and who isn't, who's in, any people who are into pinball, I recommend taking a look at the 3DS version, as well as looking at the Zen Pinball THD for your Tegra-based Android devices. It is fantastic. The ball physics are great on the 3DS. They're not fantastic. They're better on the Android. However, you'll be hard-pressed to find better pinball on a handheld than Zen Pinball. So check that out. No word on a non-Tegra version, so if you've got a non-Tegra 2 phone, which most of us do, you're not playing Zen Pinball on there. But if you do have a tablet that's Tegra 2-based, like the Asus Transformer, I can't recommend it enough. It's fantastic pinball, and it's also Xperia-ready, so if you have some means of hooking a joystick up, or you happen to have an Xperia, then you can play the game using an external controller. I don't know about you guys, but pinball to me is all about pushing buttons, not about touching the screen, as I think I complained about in the original review. But that's solved by the 3DS, so that's worth looking at. Well, listen, guys, that's all we got for review this month. Sorry, there'll be more in future months. We're running out of time and we're running out of space. I'm trying to keep the shows in a manageable size. And this month we had so much else to talk about and just didn't have the time. So hopefully you enjoyed that. Do support the platforms of choice that you're interested in. If you're an iOS guy, for God's sakes, pay for your apps, man. If you're an Android guy, yeah, you can sideload for free, but hey, why don't you go and buy a couple things at the market? Let the developers know that your platform is viable, and maybe they'll continue to support the platform in the future. Well, folks, that's going to wrap it up for the January 2012 edition of Retro Gaming Radio. Big thanks to all of our listeners, old and new. It's great to have you with the show. Join us next month. We'll have even more stuff to talk about, more reviews, more bits and bytes, more editorial commentary right here on Retro Gaming Radio. This is Shane R. Monroe saying, until next time, keep it retro.